Tonight's episode of Colors of the Dark is brought to you by Murder Road by Simone St. James. Are you ready for the scariest read of 2024? Murder Road by Simone St. James. April and Eddie have taken a wrong turn. Lost in the dark, the honeymooners are suddenly transfixed by a ghoulish glow amidst passing trees, until a young woman appears from the light as if summoned. Does she need help? Is she a hitchhiker or a threat? But she's alone and stumbling in the dark. They take a chance and offer her a lift. The woman slouches in the back seat, and April notices the dark wetness of blood beneath the woman's jacket, slowly dripping and pooling in her seat. And then she speaks, her voice faint. "I'm sorry." Two headlights pierce the dark behind them. "He's coming." Ingeniously plotted and heart-stoppingly terrifying, join April and Eddie on their honeymoon from hell, uncovering the haunting secret of Murder Road, now available in the U.S. and coming soon on the 28th of March to the U.K. Murder Road by Simone St. James, available now at bookstores. Hello and welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, fresh from the five where I have been sitting for two fucking hours. There was a wreck, but also here is Kane, who got to spend the day at home, right?
Yeah, well, that's a kid. It's not the same. I never enjoy myself when I'm, it's not as fun when I'm, when there's somebody sick. I don't, it's not like having a day off. It's just.
Aw, does he have a cold?
Get a cold. Last couple days. So my whole week's been upside down, but we have a huge 80s loop back to go into in the second half of the show, so we're gonna have to boogie at the top end with some of our picks because we have some really fun stuff on the back end, some fun guests.
Yeah, so let's jump in with one of the ones that we watched together. Oh, yeah. So first up, Hail Mary, full of grace, we saw Immaculate. We got to see this at a press screening at one of the really press screening places in Beverly Hills where they like won't let you take water in, and yeah, it's real stuffy. But that said, we were just excited to get to see this. Now, I have to tell you, I was not expecting this movie to be anywhere as near as good as it is.
Well, you would have gone anyway. That's the difference between me and you.
I totally would have.
My least favorite subgenre, besides maybe creepy kids, is Catholic-related films, because the best one was made straight out of the gate with The Exorcist. Everything else to me has been like less and less and less. But this year, the fact that there's two, and both to me, I would have thought, eh, not going to be great. And we were going to go to a press thing. I was like, yeah, it's not going to be great. And then like a day before the South By reviews started to come out, it's like, it's fantastic. I was like, oh shit, we got to go to this. And I think even then we weren't prepared for how damn good this was.
I was not. So because I have seen, so there are two films coming out this year about pregnant nuns, Immaculate and Omen 2. And then there was one that came out last year, just in latter half of 2023. There was one that I covered on the show called Deliver Us from Magnet, also a pregnant nun. And admittedly, after having seen Deliver Us and a lot of like, you know, the St. Maud and things like that, I was expecting Immaculate to be an A24 film about a nun. And so I went in kind of expecting an A24 film where nothing really happens until the last 10 minutes of the movie, and then something crazy happens. Is legit, I would have described the plot as that beforehand. This is so fucking not that. It is shot like an A24 film.
It really has the aesthetic of like a beautifully shot A24 type vibe, but then it's like an exploitation film in its
such
payoff.
The biggest exploitation film and where it goes. Even in the opening scene, like the cold open lets you know that this is not going to be a quiet, you know, subdued, slow burn horror from the start, where it's like a girl trying to break out of a convent. She's sneaking through a gate and these like sinister looking nuns are chasing her and they break her leg, not even break it. They break it off. And then immediately you're like, well, fuck. Okay, we're in.
Well, and no, especially because, and again, we're forgetting another big one that's come out around the same time, which is the Nun movies, right? And because of that, it looks just like the nun at the start of the movie. I was like, oh, it's going to be just the same old thing.
Scary
until
nun.
Until the leg, and then the leg, and you're like, okay, well, they wouldn't have done that in the Blumhouse model.
Yep.
And suddenly you knew the rules were going to be different, and that was really refreshing.
And this gets so goddamn sleazy and just feels like a 70s nunsploitation film where it goes. It just gets so, like, when they start bringing, I won't say a word about what they bring up, but let me just say some of the plot twists. I was like, oh, that's where we're going? Okay. Okay, I am so in. And there was literally one of the most grotesque and exploitive moments in the theater. I clapped and cheered in the middle of the press screening. I was just, it was so much fun.
Yeah, and Sydney Sweeney really confirmed, like, this is a big year, having, transitioned from TV, but like thinking about this, and she has like the number one rom-com of the year, and the fact that she has this, and I hope this does really well. It's really somebody solidifying themselves as a star, but also like somebody who apparently does love horror, because I started doing a quiz where she was listening to screams but couldn't see who it was, and she got Laura Palmer in Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me right. When I heard that, I was like, all right, you're legit. Let's let her do whatever she wants. This is such, and she produced this movie, was a producer of it, and is one of the reasons it came to the screen. The director is the guy who directed her in that
Michael
Amazon film. Yeah, the
Mohan.
Amazon film, The Voyeurs, which I never actually saw, but now I kind of
And
want to.
it's by a friend of ours, Andrew Lobel, who we know from horror trivia,
Right.
who when we did the WGA horror strike, he was the co-organizer with me. He was the strike leader
Ah,
along with me
cool.
that day. It was Andrew. And so I've known Andrew through horror trivia for years. So when he told me he wrote this, I was like, for me,
Yeah, no, really,
it
it
just
is.
it feels like such a me movie. So I was just so
Well, that's,
excited
and
for
that's why, I mean, this is
one.
why it's exciting. We're both going to give this glowing, like, basically one of the films of the year so far. And yet you are in the bag for this. Even the not good version of this, you probably still would have enjoyed, and I would have
I
hated.
know.
And so the fact that I loved it, it means, okay, we're both on, this is double thumbs up. We are all in the bag for Immaculate. Hopefully it does well this weekend, because it has also, without any spoilers, it has an all-timer ending. Everyone will be, this is one of those ones that people will
Cheering.
talk about, or maybe controversial, but it will certainly last. And that's what great horror films in the 70s did, and it feels like it's cut from that same mold. So congrats to
And
the Immaculate team.
We just got the press screening invite for Omen 2 today. So
Yeah, I
hopefully
want to
we'll
see
get to see
that.
that in the next couple of
And that's
weeks.
interesting, because I realized who that's by. It is by she did a season of Channel Zero and a bunch of the brand new Cherry Flavor. So, and she has never made a feature. She's only done TV. But
I know who
yeah,
you're
and they're
talking about.
really well made and beautifully aesthetic. So it makes sense that that's getting good buzz. So I'm excited to see that one too.
I will take two Nun films in 1 year, y'all. Like, if you're gonna
Yeah.
hit me with anything, maybe next year will be like the year of the aquatic horror and all things are coming up, Becca. I'd go there.
It's a beautiful thing.
Okay, so I'm gonna move you to the next one that I watched, which is coming out today, like the day this episode releases. This should be coming to theaters, and that is Late Night with the Devil. So this already got a lot of buzz because it did a lot of festivals last year. This is coming to theaters the day that this episode airs, and then it's coming to Shudder sometime in April, I believe. This is David Dalmachian playing a talk show host, a kind of Johnny Carson-ish, because they reference him a lot in it. Talk show host from the 1970s, and he has had kind of his own drama. His wife got lung cancer in this very kind of public death that happened slowly, and she was on the show a bunch, so the whole world knew that she was dying. And then when she did, he went through this dark depression. The ratings dipped on his show, and he is now back and trying to build the ratings back up as best he can after her death, and he's still very much recovering from it. We are watching the Halloween show, and we are actually watching the filming of the show. So it's shot, it gets a lot of comparisons and reviews to Ghost Watch. And that's what it feels like, where you are watching the show, and then sometimes it'll cut away to what's happening behind the scenes as well. So it feels like a camera that is recording this show that is still rolling in between commercial breaks. And so it is their Halloween episode, and he has brought on a psychic, somebody who claims to be possessed by the devil, and a woman who is a doctor who is claiming to be able to communicate with the demon inside the girl. And so they start the show, and immediately things start happening, and it slow rolls, starts getting creepier and creepier and creepier. This was fun. I had a lot of fun with this movie. My favorite part of it by far, and this is a weird thing to say, the performance was great, the script was great, the aesthetic I could have lived in for another four movies, because it is this very, they nailed it. And the set was beautiful. How the set functioned, it truly felt like a 1970s talk show. And so they really nailed that, getting the audience involved. And it gets really trippy at the end, which I enjoyed as well. So yeah, this is heading to Shudder eventually, but if you can catch it while it's in theaters, the directors of this, I loved their prior film, 100 Bloody Acres. They're Australian, I
Yeah, they are. That
believe.
was an
And
Aussie
yeah,
film.
this was shot in Australia. So yeah, that would make sense. So yeah, this had like 11 different production production credit logos up at the top. So it felt like, you know, an Australian tax credit
That's
movie
funny.
along with a bunch of others. So, yeah.
I'm really looking forward to this one. I think it did really well. Maybe won something at South by last year, or Fantastic Fest. I think it won something. I was a little bummed because that link died by the time I got it.
I know they sent me a screening link,
And I
and it
was
was
like,
like,
but that's okay.
screening links a lot of the time they're like 24 hours
Yeah.
and will self-destruct, and I think we just missed
Yeah,
the
we did.
time.
I'll watch it by the next episode, and I am excited about it. So another Shudder one that hasn't got as much press at the moment. It's called You'll Never Find Me. It comes out today as well.
I just got the screening link for
Yeah,
that.
also Australian. Directors Josiah Allen and Indiana Bell. I think it's the first feature they've done some shorts together. And the first half, especially, incredibly tense. It's basically an older guy in a very kind of isolated dude living in a mobile home in a caravan park, I believe in Australia. There's a really bad thunderstorm, and a young girl, and he's probably, you know, late 50s, and a young girl, probably under 20 or just around there, comes soaked to the door and asks if she can come in. And he's already hearing weird noises around his house and looks not completely with it. And she comes in and he lets her in. And then for the next like 45 minutes, it's really a, why is she here? Who is he? Is something bad about to happen? And you're really pretty much on the edge of your seat the whole time. It's just two people talking. Why can't they go to the phone? Can I borrow some clothes? Why didn't you take a shower? All of these kinds of things. And it's really burning with atmosphere. The whole movie is. And it has probably one of the best sound designs of anything I've seen lately, where that's a big part of the story, and kind of the off-screen space keeps you on your edge of your toes the whole time, because you're really in the space the entire movie outside of a couple flashbacks. And I don't want to say where it goes at all. Where it went, maybe at a certain point, I was a little less excited and a little more obvious to in some ways, but it's still always had me interested. I was never out of the movie, but the setup is particularly strong, and it really just keeps ratcheting up this tension. So again, a great example of what you can do with two people in one space and make a really tense atmospheric film out of it. So that one is, I don't want to spoil any of what's happening, because it's kind of, it has so little to work with because it's a two people. So that is You'll Never Find Me on the Shudder.
Okay, I'm heading over to Tubi now for a brand new film released to Tubi. And this one's directed by Henry Darrow McComas, who I know from the Monster Squad documentary. And I had seen a couple of our friends posting about this title. Josh Miller had texted me and been like, hey, new RV horror. And so I was like, okay, you know what? New RV horror, I am totally in. And this is called Camp Host. And I will quickly correct, not RV horror, van life horror. And van life is drastically different from RV horrors. RV people and van life people tend not to mix, because those vans, anytime you see one of those like fancy Sprinter vans, those things cost like $150,000. And it's always, you just bought a house. And it's like, so RV people tend to be kind of like, I don't know about that. Like, it's weird when you go to campsites, like they're oddly bifurcated. But
I'm
that
an Airstream
said,
guy who can't afford an Airstream, but one day,
like, so
that's my
another
number
one
dream in my life.
When you see the Airstreams, like, everybody's like, what the hell? Like, that is,
they cost a lot. The ones from the 70s.
Pricey. Yeah. Those are so pricey. So as I just discovered a heavy amount of leakage in my gently used C-Class trailer, which we nicknamed Classy. Yeah. It's what I love. But anyway, so I love this because what this film really nailed was the actual campsite itself. So I love the setup that it is two people who are doing, you know, the van life. They're sprinting around the country in a van, one of these really, really nice Sprinter vans. And they get to this campsite for the night, and they meet this seemingly really nice, kind of hippie-ish camp host, who is the person who brings you into the camp and gives you these rules. And this part felt really real, because when you're driving around the country doing camping or RVing, a lot of the campsites that you'll stay at, they're very small. They're run by, like, you know, this couple, and they'll bring you in. Sometimes they'll offer you dinner, and it's part of the charm of why I love camping. And then you usually will sit around with the other campers a lot of the time, or you'll get to know the people around you. And then, you know, you'll sit around and where are you from? So it is kind of this communal experience a lot of the time. If you've seen Nomadland, that is not exactly far from the truth either. So this is definitely exploring that. So it is this couple that rolls into this campsite and they immediately meet the camp host. And she's going over rules, which honestly aren't that unusual for a campsite. Like, don't take your dog off the leash. Don't let them roam around. No loud sounds after 10 o'clock. Don't leave your trash everywhere. And she's going over the rules. And you get right there that she's a little eccentric, just a little off. Like, she's not really, there's just something slightly off about her. And all the campers meet each other and they begin to talk. Where are you from? All this stuff, talking about the camp host, what they know about her background and everything. And you quickly realize that anytime somebody breaks one of those very kind of basic rules, that they will die. And so if you let your dog off the leash, grounds for killing. So it's standard slasher stuff like Friday the 13th, whereas instead of having sex or smoking up, you're breaking rules at this campground. So it functions as a really fun slasher. I had a lot of fun with this movie, possibly because I agreed with all these rules. You should never let your dog off the fucking leash at a campsite. That is so goddamn rude. And shut your mouth after 10 o'clock. I have kids. Pick up your fucking trash. I would have totally survived this movie. And so I had a lot of fun with it. This is Camp Host, now released to Tubi, directed by Henry Darrow McComas.
Well, I have never watched a Tubi original until now, so I'm going to pair it with your Tubi original. This is the first time I watched one, and I only watched all.
You watched, was All Eyes not a Tubi original?
No, it was just an indie film that was sold to
Just an
Tubi.
indie that was put
Yeah,
there?
like
Okay.
it sold. I mean, it probably shows up now as a Tubi original, but the only one that I'd at least, as far as I'm aware, the only one I've ever watched. I started it because a friend of ours, Dave Parker, directed it, and I finished it
Yes.
because it was so fucking well made. He really did a fantastic job just making a movie like this. Like, this is one I just, as you know, my taste, I probably wouldn't have watched it otherwise. It's called You Shouldn't Have Let Me In. It just hit. I watched it this morning on my, because I wasn't able to go to work. And it's really interesting. So it's there's a bachelorette party that a couple, a young woman or gay friend, best friend, are like traveling in a train at the start. They're headed to, already or obviously arrived in Italy. They're heading somewhere to see some estranged friend of hers who ended up stealing, I think, her boyfriend. And you're just watching. The setup feels to me like those kind of the kind of things that I've never watched, like the Lifetime movies about Christmas or the Lifetime, like that kind of vibe, but well written and quite modern and quite funny and more charming than I was expecting as it was going. And then they get there, and then you're kind of with, with these all these characters, everything's through pretty modern lens, but they end up at this kind of Airbnb that they've rented for this bachelorette and this group of very charismatic guy and his minions, who we as viewers obviously know straight away as a vampire. They have to be invited in because it's an Airbnb, even though he owns the building. They technically have rented it, so they have to invite in. He's trying to make a wife out of the our lead protagonist, who I thought was actually excellent. Diana Gardner was her name. I like really a just somebody interesting on screen. Hadn't been in too many things. And what I liked about the movie from here is it's like the start is good and the writing has to carry it a bit. But once it gets into the horror elements and the vampire world and the sick, it very much, I kind of pegged it as Vampire Diary meets Subspecies, or but with a hint of that 90s erotic thriller vibes. And that's what I started to really like about it was the 90s erotic thriller vibe that it kind of carried through. It feels a little dangerous and stuff. There was a sequence where they first meet on a dance floor that I actually thought, like, just on a filmmaking level, was one of the better things I've seen this year. And it wasn't a movie I wasn't expecting to see that just the introduction of the bad guy was done very, it's just done like a big set piece. So super fun. And it's just like, again, it's not the kind of movie I know we're biased because it's a friend, but I can tell you if there are movies that would show up like that where I might watch 20 minutes and be like, oh, cool, I got an idea of what they did. Congratulations, but it's not for me. Whereas this never was I actually out of this movie and I really enjoyed it and kind of made me think, oh, I hope he gets some bigger budgets to play with after this because it was so slickly made, so
I
hopefully people
was
do it.
the production design, and I know that they shot it overseas in a very luxurious
Yeah, it's
place,
all
but
Italy.
yeah,
Yeah, it's
like
in
the
Italy.
castle, everything is so beautiful. But even the way that he was filming it, like, it feels so decadent. I just deeply it was beautiful, beautiful
Yeah,
to
it was
watch.
just fun. You sometimes see these ones where you go, oh, this person did everything they could with the material. Kind of like in the 80s where people got job for hire and you see that they leave it all versus just it's a job. It's like, no, it's an opportunity. And I felt that watching this. And so congrats on that. And it got me through my first Tubi. I might, before going to your next one, just because it pairs too well, let me just give you a quick explanation because I did see another vampire film. by somebody whose directing is not quite as strong as Dave Parker's, and that but his singing is much better than Dave Parker's, and that is Glenn Danzig.
You watched the Glenn Danzig
Yes,
movie?
the new one
Holy
that isn't
shit.
out. So this is
I was gonna say, this is like hard to
it.
find
It
right
doesn't
now, right?
exist anywhere. The person who I had to watch it from, he had to go to the one, like they had some one-off screenings where Danzig sold a $40 DVD of it, and that's how I was able to watch this. $40, the sky will never go back. But that said, I don't want to completely shit on it because it's like interesting. I actually think incrementally, and I mean incrementally, I don't mean big swings, Danzig's getting better. Like it's kind of it feels directly like a direct sequel to Carpenter's Vampires, but then you take out the sound, it has like no soundtrack, and it feels kind of weird because it's just missing that element to it. But it opens with like there's a topless, very busty blonde woman on the back of a horse being held against her will, going through on a credit scene that is longer than 90%, longer than Scorsese's last movie. This credit sequence is so long. It's just like them going through the desert for like 5 minutes as she's topless. And Devon Sawa, which is one of the definitely elements that he upped, is like there's real actors in this for the most part. And Devon Sawa being the lead is a big deal. And he's really good as a kind of a man with no name, all in black. He's riding through the desert, comes across like Danny Trejo, who's a vampire, and he's running across different people. He's trying to get the sanctuary place where the only way you can get access to it's a vampire sanctuary is to give them a virgin. So they can feast on her. So that's why he's brought her through here. He comes in here and clearly it's pretty clear to us that he's looking for revenge on somebody, and you don't know who. And he gets in there, and it's still got these very, Danzig shot it. He's the DP. This film
Wow.
has 5,000 zoom shots, and that's I was counting with a counter. 5,000 zoom shots within
You
zoom
had a
shot.
clicker right
But I'm not
there.
joking when I say it'll zoom in like at a random point, not no purpose to it, and then it'll kind of zoom back out, and then it'll zoom back in again. And it's weird that you somehow work in the long run. Like they feel amateur for sure, but there's like a certain point where you pass and you're kind of like, I don't know, Glenn's just he knows what he wants to see right now. It just there are some very cheesy sex scenes and like very, his typical kind of eroticism. A lot of stuff in it that is just utterly mediocre, but for the most part, a lot of the acting stuff's interesting. But he's trying to get like the guy who killed his sister. And what was interesting, and one of the reasons I knew I wanted to watch it outside of just being, curious, was that one of the last shows I recall us doing in the, latter shows of before the pandemic of Shockwaves was when Julian Sands came on, and the thing he had just come from was this movie. And so it's a while ago, but he was like, he had a really good experience. He really enjoyed it. He's actually quite good in it. But what's fucking hilarious because you know what we all know Julian Sands' hair. We've seen him in so many movies, like thin blonde hair. In this, he's wearing like the Danzig hairpiece, this big black crazy hairpiece, and it's just bonkers. Like watching him dressed like that is so weird. He's good in it. He's like playing a serious villain. He's the main guy. Like he doesn't break. He's never being tongue in cheek. Here's the interesting thing, and this is the part. And Eli Roth has a pretty big cameo in there as a vampire.
Aren't the Soskas in it as
Soskas are
well?
like victims, actually. Like they come in and get like bitten. Like it's more of a movie than the last one was like multiple stories, and I just never got into any of them, to be honest. This one, you definitely couldn't call it good. Garo is the editor with Danzig.
Okay, so I was going to say, if you want me to blow your mind, our friend
No,
Garo is the
I saw
editor.
it in the credits, and he was editing with Danzig though, so who knows how much control. I can't imagine being in an editor, but here's the thing that'll kind of blow you, maybe not surprise you, but like was a bit of a revelation for me, is I'm watching this movie and I'm like, okay, yeah, half in, half out of it, to be honest, because it's lacking some other element. And then Danzig enters, and he's not really in the other movie. Then Danzig comes in and he's kind of playing I would call him the Bill Paxton of, he's like the Severin. He comes in with blood on his face. He looks like he's wearing like a Confederate uniform. He's fucking like, you do not want to take your eyes off him. Like he is so charismatic that it made
Wow.
me go, I think this is where he's gone wrong by directing these. Maybe he should direct them. I think he needs to be the lead in one. And I'm not saying it as a joke. Like I literally was sitting there going, wow, you're so much more interesting than almost everyone in your movie. And I would just want to watch you. And we all know he's an incredible performer as a singer and just, the most incredible career. But you're like, I think the joke of it, like a lot of people joke about it. Some people genuinely love his stuff like this. But I was watching it just going, man, I think you've got a real, and back in the day, this is something some people will remember back in the message board days, when the very first X-Men movie was being made, there was a pretty big groundswell. And this is a long time ago, a groundswell for Danzig to be cast as Wolverine.
Yep, that was
And it was
massive. That was like,
because of his height, because he's short, and Wolverine is meant to be in the comic books. He's very short compared to what then becomes what we know of. Well, and I remember it really well. I mean, there was Michael Ironside was thrown around back in the day, but I remember the Danzig comments. And now I look at it and I go, you know what? I think he probably could have been a big star of the screen in the same way that somebody like Vin Diesel is. You know, like he might have had a career in that way, and maybe he still could. But I don't know. I thought it was worth watching just for his presence, and I wish he was in a lot more of it. And now I kind of want the big Danzig. Like I want him to go Clint Eastwood and just make himself the star of all his movies, and get somebody else to be the cinematographer. That would be my notes, Glenn, if you're listening. But that is called Death Rider and the House of Vampires.
I got to tell you that after Veronica, I had no intention of watching this movie, and you have changed my
It's a little bit,
mind.
to me, it's just a little bit better, but it's also way more, like it's way more in the wheelhouse of you know what it is, right? So you can watch it just because you know what it is. It's a vampire Western. So it's, whereas the other one was kind of like, oh, you had to watch shorts and, you know, it's just never really cohesed in the right way. But,
I love the idea of Danzig becoming kind of like a John Waters of horror, if that is a thing, where like Eli Roth is in his movies and, you know, Devon Sawa stars in them. Like, you
he had
know,
talent in this one,
it,
yeah. It's
yeah, that it is going to be kind of campy and weird. And, you know, some parts are clunkier than others, but that it does have this, you know, level of appreciation from Hollywood wanting to participate. I like
We'll have
that.
to ask Garrow at Trivia on Friday because I'm
Yeah.
curious why this isn't available yet. Maybe there's still something they're waiting to do, or maybe he's only selling it. It just seems like something that would make sense to have been put out by now. So we'll keep people a lot. I did get many texts from my friend Star when he saw that I watched it, and he was outraged that I hadn't called him because apparently he's a huge fan and wanted to see this. I was surprised to learn this. I did not know this about him. Calling him out on air. So.
Okay. Did you watch it?
Oh, I didn't. I didn't. I
You didn't.
totally, I
Yes, you
totally,
did
for
it.
I
Oh.
actually just forgot about it because you just mentioned it in the next part of the interview that we will be revealing in a moment. And I was like, oh, I forgot to watch it. So you sell me on it now. Hit me.
Okay. So when I was on the musical theater or musical horror draft, on Screen Drafts a couple of weeks ago, BJ Colangelo was like, okay, horror musicals are on their way back because of Has Been Hotel. And I was like, wait, what? What's Has Been Hotel? And Has Been Hotel, it's an A24, very, very adult cartoon horror musical currently on Amazon Prime. And it's based off a YouTube. She, the creator, put the first episode that she had created back in 2019. Her name's Vivian Medrano, popped it up on YouTube. And it got so much success with that one little pilot episode on YouTube that it ended up getting picked up by A24 and Bento Box. And they turned it into this 8-episode first season run on Amazon Prime. And this has exploded. Like, as soon as you pull it up, all this fan art, the wiki, the fan lore, all it's like got this massive cult following behind it. And it is very, very adult. And here's where it gets weird for me is I, as soon as BJ said that, I was like, oh, I want to watch this. Log into my Amazon Prime and I've already watched all 8. And immediately I'm like, who in the house watched this? Marnie. And then I have to holler for my 11-year-old. And I'm like, did you watch this? And she's like, yeah, mom, all the kids at school love this. This is like huge. You can buy the shirts at Hot Topic right now. Everybody loves this. And I mean, literally, the second character in this is a porn star. The like second lead character. And so I had to look at her. Do you have any questions about anything? And she's like, no, I'm good. It's just a fun show. And I'm, okay, you can't watch this again. Like, it is very adult. So yeah, but it is very fun. The concept is it's Lucifer's daughter. It's set in hell, and Lucifer's daughter, hell is become overcrowded with people. And the way that it's currently being combated is that to battle the overcrowding, once a year, all of the angels will come down from heaven and do what they call an extermination, and they will literally slaughter people from hell. And that is their current means of controlling the population in hell. But Lucifer's daughter comes up with the idea of opening this hotel that is focused on redeeming souls so that they can ascend to heaven. And she's trying to negotiate a deal with heaven to do this. But the angels send down Adam from like Adam and Eve to negotiate. And he's a real dick. Like he's awful. He actually refers to himself as I'm the original dick. And he is. So yeah. And then, so it becomes her battling the angels and preparing for the next extermination. So it literally in her kind of leading the entire hell army behind her. But hell is not like some poetic place with like demons and pitchforks. And yes, we're united. It is a horrible place where everybody's eating everybody and everybody is like, shooting people and stabbing them. And it's just awful anarchy of horror. So yeah, this is an amazing, amazing show. It's basically she is a Disney princess character and she is singing songs from a Disney princess perspective. And if you just follow her character arc, it is that of a Disney princess, how she's going through inner battles and, fighting with her dad and the legacy that came before her, but she's leading the troops and everything. But it is set in this extremely gross, like Cronenberg-esque world where everything is awful and horror galore. I loved this so much. It's already been renewed for a second season. And the best thing is that even though these demons are all awful people and shooting each other, they're far more compassionate than the angels. And so, yeah, I just found this to be so wonderful. And you have to watch the first episode. I at least sent you the trailer. You got to watch the
Yeah,
trailer
no, I'll
because as
watch
soon
the
as you
first
watch,
one before.
you're going to be in
Okay.
as soon as you see it. And like the fact that it is a musical, don't let that stop you because this is so adult horror as well, in the amount of gore and just depravity that it brings onto the screen. It's hilarious.
Okay. No, I'm curious. I totally dropped the ball on that one.
Now, and here's the amazing thing with this. It feels like we were covering friends' projects tonight. This was actually coincidental. Paula Haefely's the producer of
Oh,
it.
cool. Also, yeah, also someone who would be at trivia.
Yeah, from trivia.
The last one I'm going to mention isn't horror, so I'll just do a brief one, but it's a perfect kind of cult slash gateway kids and adults. I got to go to a preview screening, but it comes out this Friday in theaters for Push. This is from Yellow Vale, and it's a big deal push for them because this film was shot on 16 millimeter and has a real throwback, and it kind of perfectly has fits the vibe of the rest of the show we're going to be talking about today, which is an 80s vibe. I would say this is if Wes Anderson's first film was to make his version of the Goonies, or Taika Waititi doing Turbo Kid, that would be this movie. And it's called Riddle of Fire, and it's by someone called Weston Rosoli. It's like I said, it's all shot in 16 and has this. It's kind of fascinating, really funny. It's like almost born a cult movie, and I know that's not a thing because you need time, but it definitely it's either going to be a massive breakthrough for this director, and they're going to make, movies like Taika Waititi, or it's just going to be this like big fringe cult thing. But it's these three young kids who are getting into trouble on their motor scooters, wearing balaclavas, doing like stealing Xboxes and stuff, and looking after their one mom who is completely sick on flu medicine so they can get away with whatever. It's two brothers, an older brother and a younger one, but all under like 13 or 12. And their female friend from like down the street who's 12 as well, and they're getting into these crazy adventures, very much like the Goonies. They end up getting they have to go embark on a very simple thing to unlock the video game password that they want to play, that their mom won't give them. They have to go on an errand to try to get a blueberry pie for her, and to do that they want to bake a pie. They have to get a speckled egg, and it leads them to this big kind of almost fairy tale Goonies. They end up mixed up with bad people with guns and like almost a fairy tale in the forest, and ends up with like crazy violence and like but it's really quirky, really funny. It's a big swing, and it's going to be some Brian from Pure Cinema, he hasn't seen this yet, but if I was guessing, I would think this would be a him movie. Like, he would love it. I don't know, think I was necessarily the right audience, but I was totally charmed by the end of it. And the adult audience seemed very like laughing all the way through. One of the kids is like, six, and every time he says something, like he's like those bastards or saying people are just laughing because it's kind of absurd. But I think this could be a real fun one for some of our listeners probably to. As soon as it comes out to like watch with kids and probably get a real kick because it has got that feeling of a Goonies adventure. So I just saw it and I was like, I still want to give this a plug, even though it's not hard, because I think some people who listen to this will really dig it. It's called Riddle of Fire. Definitely theaters first.
Okay, I'm going to round this out with two quick book plugs, one that's going to be a little bit longer than the other. First one I'm going to mention is Looking Glass Sound from Catriona Ward. This came out last August, and it took me this long to circle back to it. It's a long book, so I had to like wait for a stretch for me to dive in. It is about a boy who is celebrating his summers. He's spending his summer in a family cottage on the Maine coast in this area called Whistler Bay, while a serial killer is kind of plaguing the town called the Dagger Man. And he meets these friends, and it's about his summer with his friends, but it's also about the kind of serial killer that's happening in the background that's killing people, that is picking people off throughout the town and leaving weird photos around the town, and kind of the whole Dagger Man is happening in the background of the story. And it gets horror at that point. But then it fast forwards to his adult years as he is trying to write a memoir about that summer being a kid in Maine and the Dagger Man murders that were taking place on the island. And that's where it starts getting really, really good, because at that point, it really starts shifting reality and gets really trippy into what's real, what's not, where kind of, blurring lines between memory, reality, and him kind of losing it. And it gets kind of secret windowy, or even kind of in the mouth of madness, where it's like the writer slowly losing it and becoming unhinged and becoming really engaged with what they're writing. The story of just the Dagger Man and him being there in town itself is really captivating. But when it gets into kind of him looking back at it and what was real and what was not, it's awesome. So this is Looking Glass Sound from Catriona Ward. She's got a bunch of horror novels that I've read before. So this was I think she did House on Needless
The one I
Street.
read last year, end of last year, was called Sundial, I think. And
Yep,
I picked that one up
that's
random.
it.
I'd never heard of her or that book. I just picked it up at an airport. It was really good. Great cover, that's why.
You would like this one because this one is so kind of cerebral, into kind of the writing and, different selves, and it gets way trippy.
I still haven't seen Secret Window. It's one that I,
Really?
yeah, it's one of those ones that you've recommended, somebody else has read. It's,
I like that
yeah, I got to
one.
watch that one. That's just one of the few King adaptations I still haven't seen.
Yeah, it doesn't get a lot of love, but I like that one. The other one that I want to mention, which coincidentally, and this was a coincidence, was also our ad on the show this week. So it times out great. Murder Road by Simone St. James just came out this week, and I had started reading this earlier this month and just finished yesterday. I am a huge Simone St. James fan. Have read her prior two books. That I love the most were Broken Girls and Sundown Motel, were both absolutely amazing. Kind of bridges this gap a lot of the time between kind of thriller, crime thrillers, and horror, and really mixes them together with a lot of style. Broken Girls was more traditional ghost story, but yeah, I've always loved her writing. The setup of this one is that it's the 90s, and there's this young couple, April and Eddie, who are on their honeymoon, and they're driving through this town trying to get up to this. They live in Ann Arbor, and they're going north to kind of drive up to this one town where they're going to spend time on this lake, one of the Great Lakes. And on the way, they end up on this road and they have no memory of how they end up on this rural road. They just kind of appear on this rural road. And so they are driving along and they end up seeing a girl who is covered head to toe in blood and looks terrified. And not knowing what to do, they stop. They pick her up and they drive her to a hospital. And then she dies at the hospital. They get caught up in this crime of this girl of being kind of accused of what's happened to her. And they have no clue. They were literally just driving along and saw her. But it gets into this massive story of a killer that they think is kind of picking off girls along this road. But then it gets even more involved into kind of a supernatural side of it, into a supernatural killer. This was cool. This was honestly, this is probably going to be one of my top books of 2024. Again, love Simone St. James, but this is by far my favorite book she has done so far. I just loved the world that it built with the small town, how it explored the ghosts, even how kind of the supernatural side functioned was just really cool. So, anyways, thank you so much. We're going to take a brief break and then we will be back ready to dive into the 80s with our guests, Heather Wixon and Patrick Bromley.
Okay, welcome back. We are going back to the 80s, a favorite time period for all of us, to discuss a brand new coffee table book called In Search of Darkness, based on the documentary series. Joining us are two people we've always wanted to have on the show, but especially together. This is a lot of horror film BFFs in the same room. Heather
Yeah, it is.
Wixon and Patrick Bromley, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Hey, thank you so much for having us.
Big congrats. This is a really interesting book because I didn't know this was happening for a long time. I didn't hear backdoor channels or anything, but obviously this is based on the three-part documentary series that was long running. At what point did this become a book, and how early in the, development were you guys brought in?
Yeah, so it kind of all started on my side of things where I produced the first In Search of Darkness. Was fortunate enough to be like part of all three of them. And when I was working on the first one, there was talk about doing a book then, and they were like, "Oh, would you want to do it?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." And weirdly enough, my approach was totally different. I'm so glad we went this route because what I had in mind would have been impossible. So this really kind of came around again, sort of towards at the end of In Search of Darkness Part Two. It had just hit Shudder. And it was right as I was hooking up with my, not hooking up, that sounds terrible, as I was connecting with my publisher for the Monsters Makeup and Effects series. And he was like, "Hey, you worked on In Search of Darkness, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "Oh, have they ever talked about doing a book?" And I was like, "Actually, they have." So I kind of brought everybody together. And then they made their little deal agreement, whatever, and then came to me and they were like, "Oh, would you want to write this?" And I was like, "Okay, sure." And at that point, it's one thing I want to make sure people know is like this is actually covering the movies from Doc 1 and Doc 2, because this kind of started happening before Doc 3 was even like in production. So there's like 142 different movies from those two documentaries, and basically, so they were like, "Okay, let's dive in," and then we're kind of going through everything, setting the format, figuring out the bells and whistles, and I was like, "Oh my God, I can't write this book by myself." I was like, "This is insanity." Because one, I mean, it's nice to have different perspectives. But two, I doing what I did, like I think which was like 70 movies, because Patrick did two extra, was like so stressful. I feel like I still have PTSD a little bit.
I was going to ask
I'm
about
still
burnout, 80s burnout for sure, you know.
I'm coming through it. And but so when they were like, "Well, who would you want to write with, be with you to write this book?" And I was like, "There's only one person I want to do this with, and it's Patrick." Just because I was, even before we reconnected as friends, I found his writing. It was right when I was starting to write. He'd already been writing. And I just knew there'd be a really good balance between us in terms of what like our strengths are when it comes to 80s horror. And I don't know for you, Patrick, when you came into this, did you think this was going to be what it turned out to be? Pure stress for like 13, 14 months?
Yeah, I kind of did, but I was ready for that. That's what I signed on for.
How did you
So,
two meet? Sorry.
yeah, that was actually my question. You beat me to it, Kane. How did you two meet? I'm always so interested in like, because the horror community, I mean, we're global, but then it's immediately like, "Oh, of course I know Aunt Tim's." Like, it's just these like, like there's no boundary because of the internet. So how did you two meet and start working together to begin with?
Well, we actually met when I was in fifth grade and Patrick was in sixth grade. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Was
Yeah.
not, I was expecting like, oh yeah, we were on the press junket for Sinister 2. And yeah, I was not expecting that. Okay. Do you go on?
So basically how it worked out is like my best friend was a year older than me. So she went off to junior high before I did. And all of my friends knew I was like obsessed with horror. I made them watch so many different things that they probably didn't even really want to watch. And she came home from school one day and she's like, "Oh my God." She's like, "I just met this kid who kept talking about Freddy Krueger." She's like, "You need to talk to him." And I was like, "Okay." And so she had Patrick's number. So I just called this random kid up and I was just like, "Hi, I think you like Freddy Krueger or whatever." And that was kind of how it started. There's a really good poster story in there if you want to tell that, Patrick. But like, yeah, we did junior high together. I moved away for high school. And then it was like, I actually came across you, or I don't know if you came across me. Either way, like we crossed paths on MySpace of all places because we're old. And I just, that
Heather's
was
a little
also,
older than me, just so you guys know. It's not a
I will
big
get on
deal.
a plane right now, Patrick. I swear to God. And so basically we just kind of crossed paths again. And then once I started to get into my groove at Daily Dead and I could bring people in to do writing and stuff, I was like, "Oh my God, Patrick, is awesome. We should bring him in." And he was a crucial part of like when we launched our podcast too. So he came up with the Stay Scary Guys.
Oh,
So,
stop.
Patrick, tell us the true story of how you guys met.
It was the Sinister Two
What's
Press
the
Junket, wasn't
drugs? Where's the
Yeah, I don't
drugs
think
and
it was
sex and
Sinister
weirdness,
Two.
you know?
No,
No,
because I'll tell my story of how I first met Heather after this, but it was at a press junket. So yeah.
Yes.
for Sinister Two.
No, it was long before that world.
Yeah.
No, how did you actually? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Patrick.
Oh no, that is the true
Oh,
story of how
that
we
is
met.
the
That
truth.
is,
Okay.
we met. I
Making
used
sure
to
it wasn't
hide in
any
my,
additions.
no, I used to sit, I would take my mom's cordless phone and sit in her closet in the dark and talk to Heather about Freddy Krueger when I was in sixth grade.
That's pretty
No, I
cool.
think one of my very first press junkets when Fangoria transferred me out here in 2012, one of the very first press junkets that they sent me on, and I knew no one in LA at that time, no one except for my allergist. That was about it. And the Fangoria sent me to a press junket for a movie that barely had release. At the time, it was like the flight's number. It was like 1409 or something like that.
7,500.
Boom. And that was the very. So they sent me on the press junket here for that. And on that press junket, I met Elise Wax and Heather Wixon. I think Heidi Martin Nunez may have been on that press junket as well. And I remember all of us, and we were sitting together and we were kind of like introducing ourselves. And it was kind of like my first friends in LA. And it was actually really cool because they let us go on the plane and they showed us how the hydraulics worked and how they created turbulence and things like that. And again, the film had barely a release a number of years later, but it was how I met a lot of the people I still hang out with in
I
LA.
met you that way. Do you know which movie, Becca? That's where we met for the very first time, was on a press junket.
Devil's Carnival.
Devil's Carnival. We're in the middle. We're
Yeah.
at the actual
We're in
Devil's
the middle
Carnival.
of a
Yeah, it
field
was
in
weird.
like methy territory. That's all I
Yeah.
remember is like driving out there. I was like, this feels really sketch, guys.
It
But
was
then
cool
suddenly we
though.
were on a film set. Yeah, it was really
They had
cool.
lots of, it was like an actual like carnival, a place where it's always like that. So I'm curious to see what they are like other
It
times.
was a circus storage house where the circuses like store their stuff out of season.
Yeah.
Am I right on that?
Yeah, because we actually went there too, and I think on a different night. We did the special features too for Devil's
Oh, cool.
Carnival. Yeah, but that was actually there's like they were on some TLC show where they like they like loan out like carnival stuff to like different places on the West Coast and things like that. They used to do it across country, but I think they've changed a little bit. But yeah, did you guys get to meet like Ivan Moody was probably
I
there
think
and
so, yeah.
Clown from Slipknot.
I met Clown. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was such a cool press junket. So anyway,
Back to
set
the
visit.
book.
That was a set visit. Anyway, back to the book. So I want to before we dive into kind of like the five films that made us in the 1980s, I want to kind of ask like how were you watching films in the 1980s? Like I was such a video store brat and my parents did not give two fucks what I rented, so I did. But I know Elric was slightly different because he was scared. So like what
What
were
is
your
the,
kind of
where did
view?
that come from?
You told me that you were
Not
like you
even
didn't watch as
slightly.
many films. No, but
I
it
was
wasn't
just on a
until
podcast talking
you're
to someone that when I was watching these movies at 6 years old. I think you have a
Yeah, but you
different
used to
podcast
say that
person.
you're I remember this story. You really got into horror because your pastor's stepdad started showing it to you when you were slightly
You're
older, and
mixing
then
two
you
stories, but
really
we'll
got
get there
in.
because that's in my five. So we'll talk.
Not mixing two
You're
stories. I've
mixing
been
two
doing
very
this with you
different
for
stories.
12 years. I know your
No, but you
history,
don't
dude.
listen. That's the problem. Can we switch BFFs? We'll just do a trade and we'll have it'll mix up our marriages here, guys. Anyway, back to her
Back to that.
question.
Back to that. So I wanted to know kind of like how did you find your films in the 1980s? Were you Fangoria kids? Were you just video shelf combing, or was it more of like whatever comes on like late night TNT?
Patrick, you can go first because I talked too much for last time.
I started finding movies through books. I would go to the library and just check out. They had those Crestwood House books about the classic Universal monsters. And I would check those out and just memorize all the plots and the actors and all the different monsters. So that was kind of how I got into it. And then I started getting the more like advanced books with some of the 80s stuff. My parents kind of early let me watch a movie that we'll get to. And then once they let me watch that, then kind of the gloves were off and I was able to watch most of what I wanted. So I was a video store kid as well, or cable, like just I was rabidly consuming anything I could find.
Did your parents restrict your viewing, or was it just kind of, whatever?
It was kind of whatever. Like I remember this isn't horror, but I really wanted to see Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and my mom was like, "Well, I don't know. I'll let your brother watch it, and if he says it's okay, then you can watch it." So I sat in the kitchen and just listened to all of Commando, and then he said it was okay. So then I went right in and watched it probably 6 times back to back.
I love that. No, my mom would always say, you can watch it if you watch it with us. So I had these really uncomfortable conversations with my parents, like super early on, because I wanted to see like Commando. How about you, Heather?
Thankfully, I grew up in a house with a single parent, which meant babysitters were expensive. So I just kind of got brought along to everything. Like one of my earliest movie theater memories is seeing American Werewolf when I was 3, which was pretty intense.
You were like 10 when that came out, so I don't understand.
Well, at least I wasn't, already drinking like you, Patrick. I'm 21, so
Oh, good. It's good to see that mom and dad also have issues. I was worried it was just us. I feel a
We're
lot
not,
better
it's not
now.
just us.
Not
It's
just
not just
us.
us.
It's all horror married couples.
Yeah, so like it was just kind of like an okay thing in our house. Plus, like I would always watch like classic monster movies like on the like Channel 50 or Channel 66 growing up. Elvira was on and Svengoolie. So I was really lucky in that regard. And then also too, my best friend that I talked about earlier, her parents were super into horror sci-fi, and they were pretty not restrictive about showing us things that we shouldn't have been seeing, like Alien and the Thing at 5. That was pretty intense. But yeah, so it was just kind of like an open thing. And then one of the movies that I'm going to talk about in my list became sort of my handbook for horror as a kid when I'd walk through video stores, because we had a few that we would always go to. Yeah, and I just kind of always like kind of kept being obsessed by it. So yeah, that was kind of it.
That's why we're all still
There's only
here.
yeah, there was only two that my mom said specifically I wasn't supposed to watch. One was The Exorcist, because she gets really freaked out at religious horror. When she joined Netflix years ago, the first movie I put on her queue was Paranormal Activity. And she called me the next day and she was just like, "How could you let me rent that demonic movie?" She's like, "I put that thing, like, I left my house and put it back in the mailbox. I didn't even want it in my house." And I was like, "Oh my God."
I couldn't
But yeah,
stand that Mika guy.
I mean, nobody can. He's a dick. But so The Exorcist was one. And the other was actually Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which a movie I'm going to talk about kind of got me around that for the most part. And then my babysitter ended up like accidentally renting it for us because she was tired and wasn't paying attention. And just she, we had a grocery store called Dominick's in Chicago. And for a long time, they actually had a video store in there. And my babysitter part-time worked at Dominick's. So she would just send us over to the video store and just give us some money. And we'd rent stuff and they wouldn't even ask us because really, we were with Leah. And basically, that's how we ended up getting Texas Chainsaw. And then I think I turned it off like 20 something minutes in because it was too
Because of
much.
Franklin,
So
Franklin blowing raspberries, you're like, I'm out. It's too much, too
that
sexual.
is a good question. Like, what was the one that like messed you up the most
No,
when you
listen,
were a kid?
this is too
What?
early. That's the back end of the show.
Too early. This is the back end of the
This is
show.
not the list. Let's save it for the lists, unless it's not on your list. If it's not on your list,
I was gonna say,
No,
like, that doesn't
it's
necessarily mean it's on the
okay.
list. That it fucked you up for life may not be on the
Mine
list,
is. Mine
Kane.
is.
Oh my God. Then don't talk.
Okay. Well, I want to ask about the book. I was scared of
Ahead.
the Thriller video when I was little.
Oh, yeah.
I could watch a lot of movies, but the Thriller video, it was specifically the when he changes into the werewolf cat monster, because it seemed like it hurt. And I didn't like that it seemed like the transformation hurt. So I would leave the room for that part and listen to it, much like Commando, and then come back and watch the zombies dance.
Do you know?
It was
That was
the,
too scary.
I'm
That
sorry.
it was Vincent Price. That was his voice. That was too scary for me. I couldn't handle hearing him do that voice. I didn't know who he was, but when that part came on, I'd be like, "Oh, I can't take this. Like I'm spooked out. I don't know."
I couldn't do the end of the video. I could watch everything up to that, but as soon as he turned his head and smiled with those yellow eyes, I was out. So that was my moment. But I was actually obsessed with the Thriller VHS release because it had the behind the scenes because I didn't have cable. And because we I grew up in a trailer park and they didn't have cable. So a friend of mine, like her dad, bought us the VHS tape. So I got to watch like the BTS like a ton. And I think that was actually when for me things with like special effects started to click. Because I was like, I just assumed all these things existed. I thought the aliens and the thing were real and they were going to get us eventually. We just weren't paying attention because we're just watching a movie. So, yeah,
Interesting.
Thriller is
It's a big one.
huge.
I've talked about my relationship with demons too, and the demon coming out of the TV, which like fucked me up for life. But another one, big one for me, was Sleepy Hollow, the horseman at the end. Oh my God. I mean, I was probably maybe four, my parents showing me that. Like I hadn't even started school yet. And you sit through Mr. Toad and All's Well, and then you get to the Sleepy Hollow part. And when he comes down and that scream at the end, that I don't even know if I still have watched the whole thing the whole way through. For some reason, it still like affects me the same as it did when I was four.
They're spooky. I did
Oh
want
wait, but that would have, I'm sorry, we were talking 80s. That would have predated 80s. My bad. So I was
to.
specifically thinking like what destroyed me. Sleepy Hollow is definitely pre-80s. That
But
would
you
have
probably
been
would have
way
seen it in the
before.
80s,
But
though.
I was thinking Demons too, and then that led me to like my real terror, which is the Headless Horseman. So
Yeah.
yeah.
I did want to ask, like, doing the book, we were kind of alluding to 80s burnout, but also like going through all those titles again, obviously rewatching some of them, I'm sure, maybe some discoveries in there as well. What did anything start clicking to what's missing in contemporary movies most that they had in the 80s for you? Like when you're writing something as deep and watching even a movie that doesn't even work great, maybe like A Night Beast, has some sort of magical factor about it that afterwards you're like, why is this so damn charming? But if this came out right now and it was on VOD, it would be impossible to get through for some reason. Not the exact movie, but that same type of movie. So did anything come to mind that might be missing that we had in the 80s?
Night Beast is such a weird one because it literally stars the least attractive people to ever be in a movie, but I couldn't put that in the book, so I just had to find a nice way to be like, this is charming.
Especially for an erotic scene with the there's an erotic scene with it. It's pretty wild.
And I love that when Elric's trying to think of what we're missing now that we had in the 80s, the first thing
Goes
he
to
thinks
Night
of is
Beast.
it's Night Beast. It's got to
That's
be
my
Night
extreme
Beast,
example.
guys.
For me, it's imagination. I've been listening to Elric and Becca podcast for 12 years, and so I've heard Elric say before, what's special about the 80s is like imagination and the budgets to realize that imagination, or I'm paraphrasing, but for me it's imagination, because now we can really do anything special effects wise, but we're sort of limited in weirdness, I think. I mean, there's definitely weirdness going on, especially in the indie space, but in mainstream horror, it's not as creative as it was in the 80s, and it's not as fun most of the time.
Yeah, I think for me, I think it's like an aversion to risk because growing up like around like Canon or New World Pictures, I mean, I was upset. Anything that had New World Pictures on it, I rented it. And we don't have a lot of that these days. Like we've got a real like seeing how far independent horror has come over the years and the different waves of it and what kind of like comes through those like doors and like becomes like a trend or something like a really great moment like in this ever evolving like pantheon of horror. Wow, that sounds like super elevated, but I think for me it's like we're missing like Night Beast or like Dead Heat, like something like Dead Heat would just never happen today. And it's not because we're like too whatever, it's because we just simply won't take those kind of risks.
Oh,
I
yeah.
miss I miss guys like Larry Cohen or Frank Henenlotter, going out on the streets and just making whatever and like taking that risk. Like we sit there and we talk about like independent horror, but like so many budgets are coming through and it's like, here's my $1 million independent horror movie. First of all, kudos that you got money. That's amazing. Don't squander that opportunity. But like I kind of miss like the $30,000 indie, horror movies that just do what they can with what they've got. And I think Host was a movie that really proved that you don't have to have $1 million to make a killer horror movie. And I wish we saw more of that. So I think that's for me is just like I just want to see wacky shit. Like, give it to me. I don't care. Like, it just feels like there's so many people trying to ape certain trends where like
That's it.
I just want weird shit. Like, just give me everything,
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think is we are very much in a time right now of trend chasing, of kind of like, we track what we think is doing well. Oh, the A24 films are doing well. And that's what everything is going to look like the next year. And because of that, like when I was looking back through the 80s stuff this morning, it was the sheer variety of subgenres that we had going on, where it was slashers reigning, but then we had just utterly bonkers stuff and aliens and even the small budgets had big ideas. Like I remember when I was at Blumhouse for a stretch, they always had this saying, and it was like it was like high production but low budget. And the idea that it's like super like a big concept, even if you're putting it into a tiny budget. Like the first Purge was that huge idea, tiny budget. And I felt like that's a lot of what the 80s were, is Night Beast is really tiny, but that's such a big giant, world-changing plot that we just don't necessarily get now because we are trying to trend chase and keep it. If you're making a $30,000 film, it's going to feel $30,000 size too. So yeah,
And the
it's a
practical
much
effects,
different
like
beast.
right, like if Night Beast was CG now, would we care? But the fact that it is a person in a suit and it's just this a really cool costume and goofy and he's got a laser blaster and a cool silver, he looks like Bob Dylan in a silver suit. Like, what's up? It's like I'm interested, But I think, as somebody who's written a book on FX and practical makeup and stuff, Heather, it's like that is a big shift, not because the filmmakers don't want to use that stuff. It's because people are always in a hurry. Everything's about, oh, it's quicker, let's do CG. And I'm just never been convinced that that's been the right
Yeah.
direction for anything,
So what was when you were watching your 72 films for the book, what were the ones that you had never seen before that you were like, holy shit, this is finally the chance I get to watch The Changeling? Like, what was one that for each of you that you had never seen before, but you suddenly found yourself watching? Or was there one?
I had probably five that I had never seen before, and I think my favorite of the five was Russell Mulcahy's Razorback.
Nice.
Very badass movie, especially the opening. Holy shit.
Just looks amazing. I just love all the crazy backlighting and it's Moby Dick with a boar. How can you not love it?
Is such a good description of it. I hope you put that in the book.
Did
I
Moby
think I
Dick
did.
the book? Did the book have rapey Australian punks? Because I don't remember that part.
It did. They were on
Oh,
another boat. We passed them. It was really
okay.
cool. They
I'm.
screamed over "Good day, mate," and then they went
Yeah,
off. It
yeah.
was
Because
fine.
every Australian film from that era has at least three of them.
I was trying to think, and I don't think that there was anything on my list that I hadn't seen, but there were a few things that I hadn't seen in a while. And it was nice because, like, in some cases, you have to kind of just put any sort of preconceived notions or passionate feelings you have towards a movie and come at it from a completely sort of middle ground perspective, where it's like, I may not love this movie, but I'm going to meet it where it's at, kind of scenario. And so I think probably once you get later on in the 80s, it was like, okay, 976 Evil, let's do this. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna go in and I'm gonna take this. And it's never a movie that I'm ever gonna quote as one of my favorite
I
80s
was gonna
horror
say,
movies.
has it improved with time? Is it one of those where, like, if I rewatch it now, I'm gonna be like, it's better than I thought when I was 16.
Yeah, I mean, that one I saw actually in theaters because I begged my mom, because it was Robert Englund directing and Evil Ed starring in it. So I was like, I have to see this movie. I feel bad that I took her to see that movie. Oh my God. But now, kind of seeing it from, like, trying to understand, like, Robert's perspective, because I did, like, I listened to the commentary. I watched some interviews that he did from back in the day. I think I might have even read something in like one of the old Fangoria issues as well. And just kind of understanding the perspective he was coming at it from, and realizing, like, okay, you can set out to do a certain thing with a movie. What happens in the end, it may not be exactly what you were intending, but as long as that intention's there, like, I can appreciate that. So he went in there thinking he was going to make a certain type of movie. Budget and other restrictions proved otherwise, but, like, I definitely like it a lot more now than when I was a kid, for sure. There's actually quite a few 80s horror movies that we didn't get to write about for the book that I've done that with. But I think my biggest is probably still Fright Night 2,
I
because when
love
I was.
Fright Night 2. Oh gosh,
One of the
so
best.
good.
One of the best sequels, yeah.
Yeah. But as a kid, I was ready to flip cars at the drive-in. I was
That was
pissed.
me at Halloween 3, as a kid, like renting it and you and Friday 13th 5. Like they were the two things because you're just in the zone when you're a kid and you want more of the same. But then now at this age, I think both are fantastic because they're so different and fun and it's nice. That's one good thing about aging, I guess.
Yeah, mine's all the Amityvilles where it's like, it's the haunted mirror. Here's the haunted doll, the haunted lamp. And now I'm like, I will watch those anytime. It doesn't matter what haunted object is. I'm totally fucking in. But at the time I was like, but I want the house. And yeah.
Can one thing before we get into our more personal kind of journey through the 80s, talk us to us a little bit about the layout, because I was flicking through the PDF of it, the book, and also just I know this version of it just is going to be probably even sold out now, or it's very close to it, versus there will be eventually be a paperback for, like, talk us through all that stuff just so people know. But I thought the layout was super cool because it was year by year, but there would also be these cool asides, like where you'd look at the top, other movies that were non-horror that year, each year, and music, what was happening in the music charts. It's just stuff that painted a picture of the decade, not just in horror, but to kind of reflect also what was going on in the culture, which I thought was really cool. But just so people can visualize this if they haven't got their copy.
Yeah, I think for me, because I'm such a nerd for like details, like it was about kind of giving people context. Because I know that this book is going to appeal to a lot of folks our age, but I want, younger generations, maybe even older generations who in the 80s were like, oh, you damn kids with your rock and roll or whatever. That there's something to like give them like paint the picture of what it was like kind of being in that like era, Patrick. Era, and experiencing that stuff firsthand. I really, again, it kind of ties into one of my movies on my list, but it's like I just really wanted to give people that experience of like being there in the 80s, what was going on in the world, why were these movies coming up? Because that art, I think, always kind of reflects where we are at, culturally at the time. And that I don't even mean that in a political way. I just mean like, punks are a thing, and then we've got, Return of the Living Dead and things like that. You know what I mean? Like there it's not just like a little tiny sliver of what was really happening in those years. So I really wanted to do that kind of stuff. Also, just because I kind of love it. Like I used to read like the like I forget what the publisher was, but like these like weird like yearly almanac things. Because I worked at the Store of Knowledge, which was like a PBS store, and we sold these things, and I would like get caught in the back reading all the time. Because I'm like, what was going on in 1957? And just you're reading all this stuff. So I wanted to give people that kind of experience, and then. Also, too, I think it was like, as much as horror has shaped us, it's also kind of cool to see what else was going on in the movies at the same time, because as much as I loved horror, I was seeing everything. So I wanted for people who maybe weren't quite aware of like other movies that were really, I mean, although like who doesn't know Empire Strikes Back? But like just kind of like if they were going to show up at a multiplex, in 1985, what's going on?
I love
What is
that.
everybody going to?
Well, I love the charts with the film top gross, because like I only flipped through some of them, but when I got to the one where Beetlejuice is the number one in the horror top 10, and it's number 10, so it did crack the 10 of the mainstream list too, which is, it's always kind of exciting to see that horror's always been profitable, always has always broken through in some capacity.
And this is, oh, go
People
ahead.
forget just how big Crocodile Dundee was.
It was huge. I watched that with my parents and
Not
then we
me.
bought it. It may have been one of the first VHS tapes that my parents bought. But we watched that thing and Crocodile Dundee 2, where it was in New
Where he
York
used
and on the
dynamite to
subway.
catch fish at the start. I remember that one.
I know you're joking, Patrick, but I literally just watched both Crocodile Dundee and 2 because of that. I've seen like 3 weeks ago. So I love that you made that reference. And it was
It
huge.
was huge.
It was.
It was a global
I mean,
juggernaut of a
the
movie.
joke is it's not like this in Australia. That's the one joke.
Wouldn't that have been cool if they'd cast him in Rogue and the other Australian like alligator movies? Like, how cool would that be to recast those movies and have Mick Dundee? Yeah, I think they missed the boat making him an exploitation character, actually. I think that'd be more fun, but
Yeah, actually, I feel like he should be doing, like, he should be in a Wolf Creek
he should
now.
be
I
doing
would
something
totally
like that,
fucking
yeah.
watch that. Didn't he win an Oscar, though, for that screenplay? I know he was at least nominated.
For the Crocodile Dundee screenplay?
I'm not joking. It's a
That's
real thing.
crazy, but
Yeah, gosh.
believable, because I mean people were flipping out about it. I mean, even in New Zealand, where we're not quite Australian, everyone was finding it funny and humorous and loving it in the same way. I don't know how it was received in Australia itself. That would be interesting. I think that'd
I
be
think they were into
yeah,
it. I
which is
think they
funny.
never
It's
realized
pretty
that, I
great.
mean, it was huge for tourism.
That makes
That I
sense.
remember.
That was the birth of Outback Steakhouse in the US as well. We went through this little like Australian fever time period. So yeah, I'll Rick will tell you all about the authenticity of the Bloomin' Onion. All of
The
this stuff.
fads, I mean, that's the thing about it. We're joking about getting old, but I have zero regrets that I got to be a kid in the 80s and got to go to video stores and things that have really just completely shaped who you become, and you just feel spoiled, because especially when I look at, what options younger people have now, it's like it looks like you have all these options, but they're all the same, and they're all it's just so, I don't know, it feels preordained by computer choices, unfortunately.
So here's an interesting phenomenon that I have noticed with 80s horror kids that I have not been able to track to another area, and I'm looking for it. We can remember VHS covers lightning fast, even if we never saw the movie. It's things like Elric a couple of weeks ago on our Patreon show came on and was like, "Well, I finally saw Terror at Ten Killer." I have never seen that movie, but immediately I could describe that box cover down to what the woman in the lake with one hand being pulled down was wearing. And I don't even know why that is. And I don't know if it's something where we were looking at these at such a young age that it was really impactful, because seriously, I could not remember like my algebra textbook with quite that same capacity or at all. But it's just things like, and then he'll, pull out deep cuts that I have never seen, but I will remember the box cover like I was staring at it this morning. And I don't think I can do that with anything else. And I don't know if it tracks across anything else or if it was just that we were so obsessive with these films when we were looking at them at such a very impressionable age that they just stuck with us. And I assume I'm not the only one that has this ability.
No, you guys talked about, if we experienced 80s burnout, and truthfully, I didn't, because there was so much variety. Because one week you're writing about Basket Case, and the next week you're writing about The Shining, and it's like these movies couldn't be more different, but they both came out in the same decade. The only downside was that, like, we were writing in chronological order, and by 89, things were kind of falling off. And so the movies, it's not even that they weren't like as good. I mean, in some cases, like now you're writing about Jason Takes Manhattan as opposed to, Friday 4. But also I had like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer just hanging over me. Like, oh, that's in 89. That's like, I
Oh, that's
almost
a
ended.
rough one.
Yeah. Like, it's a
I'm
great,
so sorry. I really
no,
am.
it's a great movie. It's not that it's a bad movie, but it's just like, it's just waiting for me. Like, I'm gonna have to revisit that movie, and I was kind of dreading it. It wasn't as upsetting this time as it was the first time I saw it,
Wow.
which maybe I just was desensitized by writing about 71 other movies.
Yeah, you got darker.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Unfortunately,
You
you just
changed,
do.
Patrick. You changed.
Yeah,
You're
I
like
bought a
those characters.
camcorder. It's, yeah, I really am. It's.
No, but I think
I had.
that thing about the art is interesting that we remember. I think partly too, I think the art in that era, and especially the teaser trailers and stuff, was just to like, it was like whatever it takes to make people want to see it. Like, that's the only mandate. It's not about reflecting the real movie. And then now it's like, okay, well, as long as all five cast members' faces are photoshopped on the cover, it's good. And it kills me, some of the art.
I feel like we still have it to a degree,
I
because
don't
if you
know.
look like, think about the cover of the film Absentia when it came out. It was like the year where every single cover had this girl being pulled away. It was on Yellow Brick Road. And like that girl was in like two of those movies, if that. And the rest of it was just photoshopping. They were picking up just clip art. And I still feel that to a degree, where a lot of times, like, what is going on the covers of things when it's heading into, especially if it's a VOD platform, like a Netflix or a Tubi, what is going on those covers is not necessarily what you're going to see in the movie, which might go back to what Joe Bob Briggs said, which is the only place to find exploitation films now is like Lifetime and like the Mar Vista titles. And that's where exploitation grindhouse lives now.
But even the cover art on like Tubi, I was scrolling through like new horror releases on Tubi the other day, and even those covers don't stick with you the way that like do you guys remember Future Kill, like the Geiger drawing
Yes,
with the hand in
the
front of the face?
hand.
Actually, that
The
might be
movie's
example. I
like,
don't know if I ever even watched it, but I know the cover
I've never seen
perfectly.
it.
Yeah,
I
you
own
don't
it.
have to.
Yeah, never
It's not
saw it.
good, but the cover art is amazing, and like you won't find anything like that for like a new horror movie that like shows up on Tubi.
The one that I always talk about that it took me forever to rent it because I was so scared of the artwork was Body Shop. It's not even a good movie. But it was just like disembodied body pieces on the front. And then you flip it over and it's just four disembodied pieces. And it took me forever to rent that thing because I was so freaked out by it. And then there were other ones. It wasn't a great movie. It was okay. It was okay. It wasn't worth me waiting like 10 years of going, I don't know if I can handle this. But then the other one that I always look at that I use when I'm teaching marketing in class is the Headless Eyes poster. Because it is such a great poster. Like that poster just freaking slaps. I must have rented that movie five different times because I would forget that I had seen it over and over. So it was one of those movies, but man, that poster got me every single time. So yeah, it was just great art. I don't think we see it as much with the Tubi posters. Yeah, it's not the same level of tantalizing art where I'm immediately like, great poster.
Yeah, maybe I'll change again. I did want to ask you guys with the book. Okay, so the hardback is sold out or isn't sold out, just to be clear. Not quite.
No, not quite. I actually just got an email from our publisher this morning. So we have about 250
Okay,
left.
cool.
They printed 1,513, and some of those are already put to the side for the signing that we have next month.
When is
But
that, by the way?
that's April 27th at Dark Delicacies at Bur in Burbank, California. So that's we're getting close, but he said we've been getting consistent orders every day, which I'm like kind of surprised and very humbled by, and appreciative for. But when these are gone, they're gone.
Yeah. And at some
So
point there were, but not straight away, right? Months down the track, there'll be a soft cover at some point, right?
yes, we're definitely going to be doing a soft cover version, because I'm a masochist. I don't think I've even said this to Patrick yet. We might actually be adding some stuff
Yes.
to the
Good.
soft cover. Are you excited? Are you
You don't
ready?
get paid
A
more.
chapter. Are you ready for more?
Surprise, Patrick.
Now there's a chapter on microwave massacre.
Oh,
Yeah, there you
somebody's
go.
favorite.
One of Elric's faves. He
That
digs.
was one of the VHS covers that scared me.
Yeah, I see that. It
Yeah.
was that and the Company of Wolves. I couldn't,
Company of.
yeah, that's dark.
That one's fucked up. It's still fucked up. Great movie, but that wolf mouth coming out of the mouth, that one messed me up too. That was another one that I don't think I rented until I was probably in college.
All right.
I derailed us. I'm sorry. No, you're
No,
fine.
that's okay. But yeah, so we're getting pretty close. But yeah, when they're done, and then we are going to do the soft cover version. Hopefully, sometime this fall
Did you
slash
just call it
winter
the
before
soft core version?
Soft
soft
core.
cover.
They're editing Henry out of the
Soft
list.
core.
Maniac is gone. Replace them with Ghoulies films.
We're gonna insert some other movies
Oh,
instead,
all right.
from the 80s Skinamax era.
Cool.
But yeah, so because I like look, I know like $85 is a huge ask. Trust me, I get it. I have a list about, 3 pages long of movies I can't wait to get, but I'm waiting for my bonus. So like I totally get it. But if you are ready to like spend that kind of money, like I wanted this to be something where even if you think you're the most hardcore horror fan out there, that you know everything, nobody can tell you anything, totally get it. If that person can walk away from this book and they've learned one thing, then I feel like I did what I came to do with this. Because we didn't want to rehash the documentaries. They exist. You can watch them all the time. We weren't trying to do that whatsoever. We wanted to sort of bring something different that sort of was like in correlation with what they already did with the doc. Because again, if they were going to do, 10 minutes on each movie, like, they'd still be in the middle part two right now. You know what I mean? Like it's an impossible feat. So this is really so in support of what the documentary already was. And I just want people to get something new out of it.
I love the little trivia blocks that you had. I think that's really clever. They're really neat.
I will tell you like my biggest takeaway from this entire experience, and I don't know if you guys have seen it, because this is like something you see from time to time. But writing this book made me a shit ton better at trivia.
I noticed the
We're like,
last time you showed up, and you're killing it.
they rock now.
It's weird because like I'm like way more dialed in. Where like I'm actually recalling things that like 2 years ago I would have never been able to do, and I'm like, oh shit. So like if anybody out there is looking to get better at trivia, like this could be your book.
It's like the
You know, this is your
opposite of
crime post.
podcasting. Podcasting makes you so much dumber. Like over time, I forget everything now because I'm talking about so many movies. I'm just like, it's the worst
Yeah,
one.
that's it exactly. Is like when I look back and I'm like, I watched 300 films this year. I can remember 10 of them.
Yeah,
Like
no.
it's just so much. So
The great
yeah, no.
amnesia.
But Heather has been rocking
She
trivia for the
has.
past couple of
Yeah, she.
months. We have noticed. Tokyo, of
It's been weird.
course, they're lucky to have you.
I know. And I'm going to miss this week, so I feel really bad. So hopefully they do
Oh no,
okay.
that's great. Great for our team. Thank you. Boggy
Yeah,
Creek.
you're welcome in advance. Yeah, go Boggy Creek.
Well, we
Boggy
just
boy.
booked a waffle truck today. I'm
Oh no.
excited about the
Oh, geez.
waffles.
All right.
So,
Speaking of waffles, in the 80s, there are such great waffles that sometimes your parent would make you. All right. So we're going to do a quick kind of a round robin kind of journey through the 80s. Obviously, shout out to the Movies That Made Us podcast, which is a podcast where they just literally talk about the movies. And I think the definition there is really not the cool deep cuts that we love now that we look back at having missed, but really films that when you saw it and made a huge impact in whatever way and kind of shaped how you became you as horror fans. And I thought all our listeners, like the people who've been following you guys for years and us, might find it kind of fun. Some of these stories they will have heard before. But so let's just do a round robin all because Zoom's so confusing. Why don't we go Heather, Patrick, Becca, me, and then we'll keep going in a loop if that's cool. So take us from your number. Don't know if you did it in chronological or just impact, however you want to take it.
I just wrote a list
Yeah, cool. Let's do
because it's hard for me to rate. I hate new numbers.
it.
But yeah, so I would say the first movie that I would talk about when I talk about the movies that made me in the 80s and sort of made me in the horror fan I am, and it's something I've championed and mentioned many, many times, it's Terror in the Aisles, because that became my Bible as a blossoming horror fan in the 80s, that really opened my eyes to a lot of movies I may not have, you know, rented otherwise, like Suspiria at 8. Vice Squad at 8. You
Wow,
know,
that's
I know
way
you're
before
one.
me.
I know you're.
Holy cow.
Yeah, that's not. Those aren't movies I recommend to 8-year-olds. But it was cool because it was like an education, and it also became sort of like a fun challenge because I would take the cover from Terror in the Aisles because the skull is all the words or all the titles, and I would just go and start looking for movies wherever I could find them. Weirdly enough, more often than not, they weren't in horror; they were in like thriller and drama and that kind of stuff. But that's okay. It was still a good time. So yeah, Turning Isles is huge for me.
That's cool.
Nice.
Were you going to the video store like, do you guys have Nighthawks?
I might have actually because I did rent Nighthawks. That was
Because it
one of the
was in
first
that
ones.
movie. It's like
Yeah.
prominently featured in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's Stallone.
Okay, so I'm gonna kick us off with one of my gateways that I ended up obsessing over everything that they made during this time was Ghoulies from 1984 because this I watched as soon as it hit VHS. I remember like my parents renting it. It was probably 1984. I don't think I was more than maybe 5 years old at the time. And it was just everything. And now that I watch it, I'm like, I can't believe my parents never stopped me from watching any of this shit. Like, there's sex scenes in it. It opens with them like pushing out some girl's beating heart, and it's just their Satanist and their fun Satanist the whole time. And then the toilet demon, which is why I thought it was hilarious at the time. And then the two little goblin creatures. My name's Grilda. I am Hilda. I don't even remember what their names are. But it's got these two little like goblin creatures that serve him. And I thought that they were just absolutely awesome. I would have wanted to be Jonathan in this movie. I was never interested in the good or the bad, but Jonathan had ghoulies, and that was kind of the amazing part of it. But this was such a strong gateway horror that I don't even think was ever intended to be a gateway horror. But let me just say that after this, I had four Boglins. Four. So yeah, I had my ghoulies right there, and they never came to life or did anything, but I owned four Boglins.
Wow.
Heather was very kind because she knows what a Charlie Band fan I am. So she let me do most, if not all, of the Empire movies in the book.
Nice.
And I was so excited every time one came up because talk about, something that's missing now is like a studio like Empire with just, again, big ideas, small budgets, like you were saying, and so much creativity, you know?
And there are so many, they were making so many of those like ones that they were filming out of Europe in the castles that every couple of months I still end up covering one on Deep Cuts because I'm like, well, I discovered this one I've never seen before. And they're all like super sexy and shot in a castle with monsters
Maybe
or
it's the
something.
castles we're missing.
They're all really fun. That's we need castles,
We don't have any
Jonathan.
castles anymore.
That's what it's all at.
Eastern
If we
Europe's
can
still
get
there, guys. You can still go to Bucharest. It still
Those
exists.
Romanian castles were set.
Well, they were Italian because Charlie Band's dad, I think, was
That's
like a
it.
realtor in Italy. So yeah, they had like a couple different castles that they used over the years. So
Now he shoots at a mansion in Cleveland, and it's just not the same.
Cleveland's just not the same. What about you, Pat?
My first one is Creepshow, which was like the first R-rated horror movie that my parents were going to allow me to see. And it was this big event in my life. It was like, yay, I'm gonna see Creepshow. I had seen the picture of like Ted Danson and what's her name from Dawn of the Dead in the seaweed, and I was like, I gotta see this movie. Our VCR broke, so I couldn't see Creepshow. We went out and rented a VCR from 7-Eleven because you used to be able to
You can
do
do
that.
that.
Yeah, and that's how I saw Creepshow. I was fine with it. I did great until the cockroaches burst out of E.G. Marshall at the end, and then I was like, uh-oh, too much. And that was the part that I was scared of for years. But that opened up a new world to me because once I saw Creepshow, that became the card that I would constantly play. Like, can I see this movie? No, it's rated R, but you let me see Creepshow. You're right, son. And they would just let me watch whatever I wanted.
Can I make a horrible admission that, like, you guys can revoke my horror card if you want? I can't watch the last segment of Creepshow.
Is that the Roach one?
Because it's weird. I grew up without cockroaches. Like, I just didn't have them growing up whatsoever. And then I moved to LA, and no matter what you do, there's cockroaches, and it freaks me the frick out. So I cannot watch the last segment. So we literally, once it like transitions over, go right to the end, and we're back to mustacheless Tom Atkins being a dick. Because I just can't. It's weird.
It's worse than
I
you
used to
know,
watch it as a kid, fine.
but it's worse than you know because when we were doing the show at Blumhouse, we met somebody who has worked there for 30 years. I can't remember who it was, and behind the scenes, he told us that he was on Creepshow, and he said he went to the town. They went to this town in
It's
Pennsylvania.
Charles.
Yes,
I
I
think
can't
it was
remember. And they
Charles.
basically said we infested that town. When we left, that town still has an infestation problem of cockroaches, like these very specific types, and it's like a nightmarish kind of scenario. So it's actually scarier than even the movie. Maybe that's why we need CGI
When I
of the
lived in New
cockroach.
York, there were cockroaches in every. I lived in New York City for like 10 years. There were cockroaches in every building. They were in your basement. It didn't like it was only a matter of how much you controlled them is whether or not you saw them in your apartment. If you had boric acid around your base, you weren't going to see them in your apartment, but you would still see them in the hallways and the basements of all the apartment buildings. Here in LA, I never see them inside, but as soon as you step out on any sidewalk, and they're the size of hamsters here. I am not kidding. They're so goddamn big. Way bigger than I ever saw in New York City. They are just like the sunlight in the LA environment just makes them get massive. Yeah,
Yeah,
I feel you.
our sliding doors for like our balcony doesn't quite close all the way. So there's like a gap that we just literally can't do anything about. Even when the doors close, we still get rain and stuff inside our apartment. So when they crawl up the wall, they crawl through our balcony, and we'll be literally sitting there at night and just look up onto the ceiling, and there's this ginormous thing, and I'm just like, okay, time to go. And I grab my dogs and I run because I'm like, I'm not dealing with this. I can't. Like, it's so stupid. We're so quick. Oh God. Anyway, I cannot watch the Anna Creep show. And
I want that
I
watch
feel
along
like
party with
such
you.
a wuss.
But
I feel like such a wuss, but I just can't
I
do it.
love
Like,
that
I
because it
literally
means
can't.
we still, I mean, we all still have our weird things, you know? And it's like you don't want to get so hardened and jaded with horror that you can just anything goes. You still want something that you're like friction with. I'm surprised we have this one in common, actually, Patrick, because you are at least a decade older than me from what I've already established in the show. But somehow,
Oh, Rick's such a young turkey, y'all.
My number five is also Creepshow, but from a completely different angle. It couldn't be a more different angle. You excitedly wanting to see it. Me, I was 5 years old. I had only seen Star Wars basically in Gandhi, and that's all I was into. Not Gandhi, but I had seen Gandhi. Lots of Star Wars. And one day my mother was out and she was dating this guy. So that's why it's two different stories, Becca. That's just some dude. This is still in America. This is not the minister. We're in
Is this in
America. No,
Pennsylvania?
somewhere in New York. It's actually in Woodstock, weirdly enough. I lived in Woodstock for a year. And he calls up to me and my sister, who she's 5 years older, and says, "Oh, kids, Little House on the Prairie's on." And that was the show we're all into. We ran downstairs. He closed the door and in my memory, bolt locked it behind him. took out a VCR that they had thing and put in Creepshow. Now, I did not know it was Creepshow for about another 7 or 8 years after this, because I basically had nightmares for a long period based on this.
That's what I
This movie
remember.
totally fucked me up. But the only thing I remembered in the memories were the crepe monster Fluffy, and I would just see this creature, and then I'd have nightmares that he was coming out of my wall and stealing me as a kid and taking me into the wall. It was real, real vivid. And the more I think about that movie, I think it's because of the lighting, the EC comic lighting pattern, which to us as adults makes it cartoony and less real. Like it's opposite of like the A24 thing. I think as a kid that accentuates why it feels even more nightmarish. And really fucked me up. So, but it took me years before I realized what the movie was, because I wasn't thinking, straight when he showed us this movie. And man, Creepshow. So it's the most significant. There's another film at the end of the list that's the most important to me that I chose. But of the films that I didn't choose, it's easily the thing that most had an impact on me, I'd say, because of, it's that ground zero horror. So that's our first one. All right, let's keep the round
Yeah.
robin moving. Heather.
Okay. So my next choice is a movie that was like hugely pivotal in my childhood. It was something I kind of came across, and it became quickly one of my all-time favorites. And that's Tobe Hooper's Poltergeist, because I still have very vivid memories of seeing that, and it was one of those horror movies, like when you're a little kid, like it feels like in some ways safe, and then he completely pulls the rug out from underneath you multiple times, so that when he builds that false sense of security up again, you're like, oh no, we're the nightmares are going to continue. And I was obsessed with Poltergeist as a kid. It's I still watch it a lot to this day. It still makes me cry. I think Joe Beth Williams gives one of the best performances in 80s horror in that film. And I love it so much. It's a movie that, if we had more time, I could literally do like 5 hours on Poltergeist. Patrick had, we get to talk about it soon, which I'm excited about. But yeah, it's just one of those movies that, like, if my fir like that was probably my first like horror movie obsession was Poltergeist.
Which of the elements, did any of the particular elements, like some people it's the tree, some it's the clown, some it's the
Clown.
corpse, some it's the meat face. What was it for you? Was there a specific?
The clown in the idea of her being in the TV, because TV was such a pivot. Like, I know it's still a pivotal thing too for most kids, but like it was extremely pivotal in the 80s, especially if you were a kid who kind of was growing up on your own a lot and you were a latchkey kid. Like, the TV was like, your best buddy in a lot of ways. So the idea of like you getting pulled into there, this clown doll, which I don't think I've ever really liked clowns, but I especially didn't like them after that. It just, like, why they would even just keep that doll around afterwards, I don't understand it. Like, and sitting at the foot of the bed when everything else is packed. But yeah, it blows my mind. Every time I watch, I'm like, why is that there? Like, you guys are moving right now. Get it out of here.
So good.
But yeah, it's just one of those, it perfectly captured, I think, a lot of the fear that comes from being a child, and especially during being a part of that generation and how things were changing. And I think also too, it's a really great take on sort of breaking down what like the American family was, what this idea of like community and security was, amongst families in America at the time. It works on so many different levels. Like, I have to shut up.
No, it's great. It's great.
I still consider it to be one of the most real portrayal of parents ever,
Yeah.
especially the bedtime scene. Because I remember, and looking back at the 80s when I was doing it for a project, because we always had to have the quintessential sex scene in the 80s. It was like parents who have been married for 20 years are sleeping in sexy stuff and then going to bed and it's all sexy. And there in this one, he's reading a book on Reaganomics while she smokes a joint. That is every evening for me. And so I was like,
That
nothing
was so
sexy. Nobody looks hot. We're just in sweatpants, and that's it. And that's life. And I
and
love it.
yeah, and what's really interesting too about that scene is because it was sort of the quintessential parents of the 1980s, because you had all these adults who'd come through the 60s, Vietnam and everything like that. So they're still smoking weed, but like they're also into Reaganomics because suddenly that's like a thing. And it's such a perfect juxtaposition. Like, if somebody did that scene in a very similar style today, like there'd be such backlash against it from like everybody, where I'm like, but it feels so like
authentic and real when you frame it within the context of the 80s. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, I still smoke a joint as soon as my kids go to bed. Like, that's just what you do. I mean, we're in California. That's like the thing here. But yeah, that's how I get to sleep at night. So that takes me to Little Shop of Horrors.
Which version? Oh, yeah, of course, the 80s version.
Which version?
Yeah.
The 80s version. So the 1986 version. So Little Shop of Horrors was definitely not even gateway. Like, this was 1986. I was like full blown horror junkie by this time. But at the same time, this for me was a big permission slip to let my freak flag fly. The fact that I did love musicals, that I did love kind of this weird twisted element of mixing merriment and horror together, which I'm going to talk about in the first part of the episode with Hazbin Hotel, if you haven't been watching that. It's amazing. But just the idea of kind of the happiness of the musical and just the singing and the dancing and just turning it upside down and mixing it with just brutal stuff. And that is still, I was just on Screen Drafts last week for horror musicals, and it is still one of my absolute favorite subgenres. Little Shop, some kids would probably play Barbie. I closed my door and sang every part of that musical and pretended I was every part. My stuffed animals saw the one person Becca show of Little Shop of Horrors daily for like 4 years. I hope they enjoyed it. It was amazing as far as I can remember. But yeah, this was such just a massive one for me of kind of letting me know that horror doesn't have to be scary. It's fun.
Definitely
I
show
want
in
to
the
see
theaters,
Rebecca do somewhere that's green. I want to see
yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of an alto tenor, so it is
it.
a little scratchy.
I can relate. Yeah. That was actually one that I actually had the soundtrack for before I saw the movie because my mom's boyfriend at the time was working at the distribution center in right outside of O'Hare for Warner Elektra Atlantic. So we would get albums ahead of time. And so I knew those songs before I even got to see the movie. And yeah, I love that movie so much.
Gosh, yeah. And even the stuff that is not like part of the musical, that was not part of the stage show, like the whole Bill Murray scene and a lot of the add-ins that they get and the cameos, like it just makes it so much better and it's just fantastic.
Do you have a preferred ending?
Oh, I like it bleak. I like
Really?
Don't Feed
Okay.
the Plants.
Okay.
So yeah, I know Elric's not a music buff, so
I
I
did see this
assume you
one. I
have.
saw it on theaters when I was a kid.
But did you have you seen both endings?
No, whatever was
So
in the
there
theater is
is
probably the only one I saw.
that's the Somewhere That's Green ending, where at the end, Audrey and Seymour run off and they have the beautiful house. And then in the foreground, you see a tiny little plant in the garden. And then there is the ending that comes from the actual stage musical, which has this song called Don't Feed the Plants. And it's basically this massive plant takes over the entire world. And they filmed it. And I swear to God, it's like 7 minutes of footage. And it has that 7 minutes feels more expensive than the entire film because it's like giant plants wrapping the Empire State Building and tanks and things 30 feet. It's like Godzilla plants coming down the street with all of these tanks and helicopters and all this stuff. And I'm like, wow, how could you guys cut this? Because it literally feels more expensive than the prior 90 minutes. I like that one because it's true to what the stage version was, where there is no hope. There is no someplace that's green. The plants just take over the world. But that's me.
Pat. My next one is A Nightmare on Elm Street. That might be on somebody else's list, Heather. It might be on yours. For a lot of reasons, again, so much of my horror consumption as a kid was in like book form, and it was based on these movies that I couldn't see. And once I was able to see movies, because they weren't showing a lot of the Universal monsters like on TV regularly, and except for like Svengoolie. So I was just reading about them, but then once I was able to start seeing movies, it was like more contemporary stuff like Creepshow, like A Nightmare on Elm Street. And that was one that like I think my parents didn't want me to see, but a friend had described it all to me and it sounded like the scariest movie ever made. And so I went to his house and watched it. And so it has that element of like forbidden fruit that a lot of us horror fans kind of seek. And also it's, as we kind of explained earlier, it's a big part of the reason why Heather and I are friends and why this book exists. So I feel like it belongs on my list.
We're tracking pretty well here, Pat. My next one's Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay. All
Our
right.
order is, and it was again similar thing. I was already getting more into liking horror films, like not being just scared from Creepshow. But friends invited me over, and I got there, and right when that early part where he just kind of appears for the first time with the first kind of shock, a bunch of them jumped on me because it turned out they had just watched it before I got there, and this was all a practical joke to make me piss my pants, which I didn't, but I almost did. And it was probably the most scared I've ever been in a moment in my life because it was so timed with the aesthetic of that movie. And that movie's just it's a really scary, brilliant movie that also makes you love horror. Like it does both, and not many. It's in a category of maybe just a handful of movies that can also both scare you and be one of the greatest creations ever. But also just the scene, especially in the school, like the scenes that just stayed with me forever. It's just this scene, where she's in the school and seeing the girl in the bag, body bag being dragged through. Just little surrealist touches that he added through this because of being able to play with the dream element made this movie so impactful and definitely one of the ones that made me love the genre too. So. Great choice. Hopefully, all five of ours will be exactly the same. And we will
I
reveal
hope
we are
so.
twins, even though you're old.
Yeah, so actually my next movie is for real on Nightmare on Elm Street.
Hey!
So we are three for three. Yeah, this was a movie that I was allowed to see, but it wasn't an easy shot. I had to work for it a little bit because my mom and my best friend's parents rented it and they were like, we're gonna watch it first because we've heard some things. And so we were in her room just kind of waiting it out. And we couldn't wait anymore, so we actually snuck out there, and it was the scene because we were hiding behind the couch, and they were in the middle of the living room watching it, so we're right behind them. And it was the scene when Nancy's running up the stairs, and she gets stuck and starts doing the thing, and my friend was like, "Oh shit!" and like really loud, and the parent, like everybody was like, "What?" and they paused it, and they got caught. So I had to wait a few more months, and then I was at my babysitter's house, and she had on a VHS tape. Somebody taped off like HBO or something like. It was a double feature of Children of the Corn and Nightmare on Elm Street. And I was like, oh my God, I want to watch this. And I was staying that night at her house because my mom was working. And I was like, oh, I really want to watch this. And she's like, you got to check with your mom all. And I was like, okay, fine. And my mom basically said to my babysitter, she's like, if you want to deal with her, you can let her watch it. And I was like,
You want to
yes.
deal with her.
Yeah. And so, like, I mean, I don't even love Children of Corn as a movie, but it's a pretty effective horror movie when you're a kid. Because it feels like the rules are way off. And then so I went from that into A Nightmare on Elm Street where it just felt like there were no rules. And it scared the shit out of me. Like I remember that night I had to get up to go to the bathroom and like she had this very narrow hallway. And I just remember like folding myself in and just running straight down the hallway because I didn't want Freddy to come out of the walls to get me. And it's weird because I was like as scared of him as I was obsessed with him. And I was like very shortly after that, I got like a Freddy Krueger poster on my wall. So all my friends thought it was weird when they would come over because like I had like the Bop and the Teen Beat little mini posters you'd get, but I also had Freddy Krueger and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah,
I was
kind of
not
work
a ch I
together,
was
yeah.
not a cool child. Yeah, I was not a cool child. But so everybody thought I was like this really weird girl because it wasn't like it was just, pictures of, I did have a wall of the Coreys though. So I had alternating Corey Haim and Corey Feldman's,
Who
but.
who's laughing now, Heather? Who's laughing now? Who's
Exactly.
got a book on
Exactly.
the almost sold
Yeah.
out?
Yeah. So, but yeah, so Nightmare on Elm Street was absolutely huge for me. And that was probably after like Poltergeist is like my first obsession. Then kind of came Salem's Lot. And then came, well, that's weird. That was two Tobys. And then came Nightmare on Elm Street. So that's probably why we do a podcast, Patrick.
That's right.
Yeah. So yeah, and then A Nightmare became like the obsession for me for the 80s. So
We all share nightmare, I think. I mean, I know Becca's
nope.
a different nightmare, but
Yeah,
a different one for her at some point. But yeah.
but I didn't put
No,
it
I
on
know.
the
Yeah,
list. No, I didn't catch the nightmares. I started with three, and so that is my favorite of them. And then it wasn't until later that I went back and watched all of them, but because I saw three first, that will always be my fave. So yeah. So my next one is Pumpkinhead from 1988. So Pumpkinhead, I watched at my next door neighbor's house. My next door neighbor was a couple of years older than me, this guy named Matt. And I remember that our parents had all gone I want to say that they had like a PTA meeting, but honestly, they probably were out drinking. So they'd all gone out drinking and they'd left Matt to babysit me. And again, my parents didn't really care what I watched and neither did his. So we had rented Pumpkinhead from the 7-Eleven, which is where you rented movies, and we could walk to a 7-Eleven from my house. And I remember Pumpkinhead kind of being next level for me because it felt like my home because I'm from like this really rural area of Virginia, this really mountainous area of Virginia. We're in the Shenandoah Valley, which is like this valley in the Appalachian Mountains, and very backwoodsy, especially at the time in the 80s. And it felt like home. And the witch felt like the mountain witchcraft called Granny Witches that we had in the area. And it felt so much like like a story I would hear, like a story about the area around my house. It felt so much like one of the local ghost stories about the things and the witches in the mountains and don't go to that cabin and things like that. It wasn't until much later that I actually found out that that's not even filmed in Appalachia. It's shot in like Santa Clarita.
Probably.
And I was like, oh, fuck. But at the
It's the
time,
Appalachia
that
of California.
Santa Clarita.
LA, you know. We're out here.
It's the only place we have trees, so I guess we're
Yeah.
going up to Saugus. But yeah, so but that the story itself just felt so much like a mountain tale that I had grown up with, and Pumpkinhead ended up becoming one of my favorite films throughout most of my youth, and it was one that I remember not sleeping. I remember being up at night thinking about Pumpkinhead and being freaked out by it and the rhyme and everything and the kids. It felt so close to what I had experienced in my childhood.
I love that you had that experience though, because like my mom's family is from West Virginia. So literally my grandparents lived on a hill that like and just everything behind it was woods.
That's where
So
our house is.
I had a very similar reaction because my grandpa growing up, because I had sort of like strawberry blonde hair, they used to call me Pumpkinhead. I made them stop after Pumpkinhead came out because it was too much.
Wow. So
So
the house I grew up in, well, the parent one my parents still live in, it's 3 miles from the West Virginia. It's Winchester, so we're at like Martinsburg,
oh,
West
okay.
Virginia, Cape and Bridge area. So yeah, it's like all
Yeah, I
right
know where
there.
Martinsburg is. Yeah.
But that my parents back up against one of the mountains, and so yeah, like it's straight uphill, and you know, just seeing the woods behind you and the trees around your windows. Pumpkinhead messed me up that night. So
Oh, I get it.
yeah, it's intense.
Mine are just chronological in order of release date, I think. So my next one is Night of the Creeps, which I Heather, you probably heard me talk about this before, but my family would take one vacation a year. I won't be autobiographical about all these, I promise, but we would take one
Well, we're
vacation a
supposed
year.
to be. That's kind of the
Oh, that's right. That's
assignment.
right. Okay. I will be. I grew up, no, I'm just kidding. We would take one vacation where my dad wanted to fish, so we would drive up to like a North Wisconsin and he would fish for a week. And my parents wanted us to sleep in the car on the way there. So I hated the fishing trip. I was bored. I would read comic books, I would read books, I would burn through all my books and move on to my sister's Babysitter's Club books, like because I didn't fish. But the best part of the trip was the night before we left because my parents wanted us to sleep. So they would let us stay up as late as we wanted. They would go to bed and they would say, stay up, and we could watch anything we wanted on TV, which meant they showed all the freaky horror shit at like 11 p.m. and midnight on cable. And so that was how I saw Night of the Creeps for the first time. And I saw a bunch of movies. I saw John Carpenter's The Thing that way. I saw a Basket Case that way. And I saw Night of the Creeps, and Night of the Creeps is the first movie I can remember that was like a horror movie that was really funny, that pulled from all these different, it's part science fiction, it's part frat comedy, it's part zombie movie. It was like I didn't know a movie could do that, and it imprinted on me in this major way, especially because then for a lot of years it was like hard to see once it didn't get a DVD release for a long time. It didn't get a Blu-ray release for a long time. And so it was kind of stuck on VHS. And so it existed in my memory as this movie that I thought of so fondly, but I couldn't go back to. But it was a movie that taught me that, like, oh, movies can kind of do anything they want. And it's very quintessentially 80s in that way because of the way that it wears all these really fun influences, and it's such a kind of perfect tonal balance, I think. It's a movie that really could only exist in the 80s, which is part of why I love it.
It's funny, if we were doing trailers that had the biggest influence, I saw that trailer 100 times before I saw the film. It was my favorite trailer would come on. Every VHS tape was Night of the Creeps, and it was such a good trailer. I mean, had just, your dates are here, the bad news is they're dead. Like, all that stuff made me want to see that movie so bad. But funnily enough, my pick isn't that, but it's a similar kind of movie. And this is the most outlier of these from my favorites. And people don't believe me when I tell this, but in New Zealand, when I was this whatever age this was, whatever their ad campaign, it had reached the shores of New Zealand saying it was the scariest movie ever made and that most people wouldn't be able to handle it. It was like, and you're gonna laugh now. And then I saw the poster for it and I was like, oh my God, this looks too scary now that I've heard that. And it had a little hand that said, Ding dong, you're dead. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not gonna survive this movie. And then I watched House, and even though now I would watch it and laugh, it really, whatever the state it put me in, the first part of that movie, to this day, I find that the purple lady, it wasn't Bull from Night Court as a Vietnam vet, which should be scary. It was this creature in purple who kept charging out at him, and then he cut her up. For whatever reason, that scared the pants off me when I was young. But I do think, similar to you, as the movie went on, I started to realize, oh wait, this is also making me laugh. How can I be scared? Because a lot of horror comedies are really just comedies that happen to be in a horror genre, right? They're just totally broad comedies that happen to have a werewolf or something. But this is a true horror comedy where you're scared one moment and then you're laughing the next, like Reanimator. And it was really liberating and exciting. And I knew I liked this movie a lot at the end of it. But whatever their campaign was, it was so funny to me to think that this is the movie that people were kind of saying, this is going to be the scariest movie of the 80s. But I still have a soft spot for it, but it's kind of an outlier in the others. It had a big impact, but it wouldn't have been, like, if you asked me my 10 favorites, it wouldn't usually come to mind. But it definitely is. It was there. So Steve Miner, who has also made a great movie in like every category he's ever been hired in, it's kind of
Yep.
remarkable. Hard to get him to talk about. I've never heard him really talk about horror, but would love to.
We had somebody on Shockwaves that worked on
Oh,
House, and I can't
Decker. Fred
remember.
Decker wrote the
Decker, that
original.
was it. We
Yeah, we
had
did.
Fred
He
Decker.
wrote the original, and then his
Yeah.
roommate made it funny, basically, because he was trying to make it pure of scary Twilight Zone. Anyway, House Purple Lady, and there's no name for her. I keep looking up to try to find a good name for that monster character, and I never can find anything. It's a shame.
Okay. Heather, hit us with another.
Yeah, so mine is probably pretty obvious if, like, you've ever seen me on social media. But it was a movie that really sort of changed what I thought I loved about horror in a very significant way. And it was like, I had three movies I was super obsessed with as a kid. This was one of them where, like, if I was having people over, if I was at somebody's house, I'd be like, okay, we have to watch one of these three movies. And this would be Tom Holland's Fright Night. Because I did have a childhood where I grew up watching Universal monster movies, but they were different. They were less impactful on me then than they are obviously now, because you get it better, I think, as you get older and have a little different appreciation for them. But I still watched them, and I was still really fascinated by a lot of those characters. And I know I'd seen some Hammer here and there again, like on the weekends and things like that, and then watching stuff again, Elvira and Svengoolie. But what I loved about Fright Night is, like, one, I was just obsessed with vampires to begin with, so that was an easy in for me. But then I love the fact that, like, Charlie Brewster is this like monster kid, which, and I've said this before, like, I don't think it's a secret. It's pretty obvious. I think Tom Holland owes a lot to Salem's Lot with what he does in Fright Night, and I think it's all love. There's a lot of same setups. You've got the characters that are kind of mingling in the same way. There's definitely a different spin on it, and I love the fact that, again, I think Tom Holland did two of the best sort of horror movies about single, like, kids being raised in single parent environments, dealing with, like, really shitty situations. And again, that's something I kind of appreciated, just based on things I was going through. But I love Charlie Brewster, and I loved Ed, I loved Amy, I loved Jerry Dandridge, still do. Every like that movie to me was just such a wonderful, like, reintroduction to sort of a completely different experience for horror.
Because I was watching mostly like Friday the 13th movies or Nightmare on Elm Street movies, or I wasn't really getting to get that kind of an experience. And then I think also too at that time that it just really, I think it sort of added on to my love for like Elvira, because I got it then. Because then it was kind of like that movie gave me context for what that type of person in this like world actually means and what they're doing, and the things that they can sort of face. So yeah, Fright Night was huge. Amazing effects, wonderful soundtrack. Yeah, it's definitely a favorite.
And you would never get Terrorvision without it. So
No,
another good host.
no.
But yeah,
So, and
Fright
you
Night. Very
keep,
true.
I do have to say, because both of you I know are from the Chicago area and you've both mentioned Svengoolie. This is another thing that I've discovered with 80s kids is you can immediately tell what area of their country they're from by which horror host they watch. Like mine was Count Gore Vidal because we were in between DC and Richmond. So we got Count Gore Vidal out of DC and Bohm and Bodie out of Richmond. And so like somewhere we got both of them. And so yeah, but like I'll hear other people be like, oh no, I got blank. And I'm like, oh, you're Seattle. And so yeah, it's like if you know your horror host, you can immediately figure out where they are in the world and
And
how it.
I was gonna say, I immediately get sad for anybody who didn't get to grow up with a horror host.
Yeah, like
That to me is a bummer.
yeah, those curated, like even thinking like a USA Up All Night, there were so that curated weekly viewing, which we have a little bit now with the new Joe Bob Briggs, but like there was so much stuff that popped up on USA Up All Night that I never would have watched on my own. But because, Rhonda Shear is like bouncing around to it, I was suddenly like, okay, well, I'm gonna watch this for the next 3 hours. Yeah.
Totally.
Okay, so that takes me to Leviathan from 1989. So it was just a guarantee I put at least one aquatic horror on this list. And then I was like looking, okay, well, I've got from that year Deep Rising, The Abyss, and Leviathan. And Leviathan is by far my fave. So if I think kind of what one of my biggest movie, like in general, kind of movies that informed me would be Piranha, which is from the late 70s, or else it would be on this list. But that movie just, it looks like the house I grew up in. We on a river, we were on the Shenandoah River. And so I was consistently scared to death, but yet in love with everything underwater and how kind of weird everything is. I was like obsessed with leeches and just, I was a really weird fucking kid. And so, yeah, then going from that to seeing Leviathan, where it is this level of weird body transformation, it's body horror, and the creatures are weird, and everything's about just morphing and just changing consistently. And the thing where she looks down at her arm and she sees these little tiny worms like circling back and forth inside of her broke open flesh, fucking just freaked the shit out of me. But I could have watched that shot for another 10 minutes staring at it. And that weird kind of level of fascination, repulsion I found in Leviathan. I love this movie so much. I don't know if it makes sense. I don't know if it's the most cohesive plot. I don't know. There's something in the vodka that made us all start morphing, and then we all became one giant monster. And then at the end, we threw a flamethrower into its mouth. Whatever. I don't care. That giant leech thing that DeJesus got on his chest fucking kicked ass, and I'm in for every minute.
Well, if we had extended this to sci-fi, also RoboCop would probably make a bunch of our lists. So it's good that Peter Weller's making this
He's in
list.
here.
I
He's
appreciate
in
that.
here. Yeah.
My next one is a movie I forgot. Oh, it's The Blob,
You forgot.
the Chuck Russell remake
Nice.
of The Blob. Still one of my favorites to this day, and a movie that, again, I sort of imprinted on at a very early age, watching it on VHS as soon as it came out. It's a movie that made me like very aware of special effects in a way I hadn't been before, because I couldn't figure out how they did so much of it. And now, having listened to your guys' interview with Tony Gardner, I know how they did a lot of it.
I still can't
I could
visualize
read about
it.
it in the book
Like crazy.
that Heather wrote. So there's
Nice.
lots of places I could go to find out how Tony Gardner did it. But also, I had said about Night of the Creeps that like I didn't know movies could do that. The Blob was one of those movies that like, oh, I didn't know you could kill a kid. Like, how is that okay? And it's a movie that I became very protective over. It became mine in this way that was like part of my identity, and I would want to show it to other people. So anytime we would get together, like for a sleepover to watch a movie, I would always be like, "You guys got to check out The Blob." And I turned a lot of people on to The Blob. Hopefully, I'm leaving my mark on the world.
That was one of my favorite feelings is of that time is the sharing movies. I mean, might be why we still do this stuff like podcasting and writing books and, you know,
For sure.
the sharing. My next one, very simple, and I'm sure everyone had different relationships, even though the second might be more entertaining now. When I saw The Evil Dead or Evil Dead, I did not. It was the first time I realized you could make a movie. And I'd seen some Polish short films once, like one by Polanski, where I suddenly was like, oh, they're making this with their hands. I get it, because you see the edges. Evil Dead was the first feature where I was like, wait, this is, you can tell they're just doing this somehow with a little camera. And I loved it as well. It was like instantly one of my favorite movies in that moment, and still scary, you know, the trees and just stuff that was quite disturbing. But I just, and the crazy camera work. So this one instantly inspired multiple short films that we made, you know, straight away with somebody's like handy cam. I can't remember what it was, but like there's a whole bunch of movies. They're just straight Raimi rips that we made when we're super young, me and my friend Alex. And then right after, I'd almost have to double and do a cheat here, because right after I saw Bad Taste and being where we were, that was the first time I realized, oh, not only can you make this kind of movie, but you can do it right here where we are. And so those two movies back to back were like, oh, this is crazy. Let's just do that. I don't know if I've evolved mentally at all, but those two made a big impact at the moment, and they're definitely responsible for me seeing behind the curtain that these weren't just things to be consumed, but you could inspire you to want to do it. And that's what, you know, and then once you read up about him and learn he's 21 or whatever, it like blew my mind and became the biggest, you know, huge Bruce Campbell fan when I was young, and just yeah, all that stuff. So Evil Dead. Thanks, Sam.
Yes, I think my final one, again, growing up in the 80s, I didn't kind of know what indie horror was, but I knew when I watched this next movie that it was something really different. And I think it imprinted on me in a very specific way, where I suddenly had an appetite for things that just were really out of the box ways of approaching stories. And that was Kathryn Bigelow's Near Dark.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Because growing up, as I said, I was obsessed with vampires. After Lost Boys, I started a vampire hunting club. I have a vamp poster in my dining room.
Oh
Like,
yeah, you showed
I go
Vamp
to
at Jump
the
Cut. I remember you brought Vamp
I
at. Yeah,
did. You know
that was great.
it. I showed vamp at that catastrophic
DeeDee Pfeiffer
screening.
was there.
DeeDee
I
Pfeiffer was
wasn't.
there. I know. I was. So for me, Near Dark was something really different, because all I knew was a vampire movie. Even though they never say vampires in the movie, but it was like a complete 180 from anything else I had seen throughout that decade. I mean, I think the closest thing that came to it was The Hitcher, but it shares the writer, Eric Red. So there was something very just completely against the grain about the way he approached stories, and it made me really fall in love with sort of this new that you could take things that were really familiar and were the trend and come at it from a completely different perspective. Because if you look at the variety of vampire movies we had in the 80s, we were getting all kinds of different things. It wasn't just trying to redo Dracula over and over and over again. And so for me, Near Dark was that. It felt unsafe. It felt really rough, but like not in an amateur way, just in a I'm living it kind of way. And just the performances were fantastic. The score, like just the way that like breath would hang in the air in those night shots, like I can see it. Like I can close my eyes right now and I can see that. And that was just such a huge movie for me. And then I remember like a few years later, Blue Steel came out, and I was like, wait, that's the lady who did Near Dark. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And so that was like, it really, that was when I was starting to put directors and things together. And I was like, oh wow, this lady comes at things very differently when she takes on very familiar types of stories. So that was like the beginning of my lifelong love and appreciation of Kathryn Bigelow. It's phenomenal. I will never complain about the stupid Twilight-esque art on the Blu-ray that came out in 2009, because I at least own it. And that artwork can't take away from it. So for everybody who was bitching and moaning then, they're like, oh, look at this artwork. And I was like, yeah, don't buy it. That's fine because now it's out of print. And everybody has to wait every 6 months for Shudder to get it so you can watch it again. And then it goes away. So, you know,
Do you think we could ever
I'll
get
take terrible artwork.
another horror film from Catherine Bigelow, or very unlikely?
God,
I'd love to see her in the
I
genre.
wish.
Yeah.
I feel like at this point, probably not. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why, like, how somebody wins Oscars,
Yep.
but
It's the
yet
weirdest.
still,
Make movies.
like, doesn't just have that door open for them.
Years in between each film. Yeah,
Yeah,
it's really strange.
it's well, maybe she's just really picky. I'm probably deluding myself here, but I like to think that she's just continuously reading scripts and like 30 a week, and she's just not, no, this one's not right, not right, not right. I hope she's doing that. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, she made Point Break. If they're not going to be at least Point Break worthy, like, why bother?
Yeah. Oh, I wish one day come back to us, Catherine. Come back.
I would love it.
Okay, so I decided to end my list with the one that carried me into the 90s, that kind of made me the teen I would become. And that would be They Live, because when I look at, like, usually when people are thinking about, like, the punk rock movies in the 1980s, it's like Class of 84 and like Return of the Living Dead. But I always look at They Live as one of the most punk rock movies of the 1980s. I watched this with my parents probably 1989. I was probably in fifth grade and just thought it was cool because aliens with no face. And then it wasn't until a couple of years later that it, and when I was going into high school, that I realized that it's basically like if Rage Against the Machine was a movie, this is that movie. And then it became everything for me. And this movie was such a huge part of my angsty, despondent teen years. Religion is false, money is evil, corporate America is trying to enslave you with, like, Ronald McDonald, and you're a narc. And that was like everything that I was when I was a teen, was just rebelling against it. And this ended up being like my go-to. Like, I'd be on dates and they'd be like, you want to read liner notes of, like, Pretty Hate Machine? And I'd be like, yeah, but have you seen They Live? Like, this is the one I would always pull out on, like, my angsty teen dates and show people. And so I've only slightly gotten out of that phase, slightly. I think it sticks with you. I basically would still shop at Hot Topic every chance I get if I could. So yeah, but this is the movie that carried me into what I was by the time I was 16 and became the movie that I, 16-year-old me, would have held up as, like, this is what I believe in. And there it is.
I can't believe dates made you read the liner notes of Pretty Hate Machine.
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure I was like, do go on, Robert. This is amazing.
What's
Oh, you're so dreamy. You're probably in a graveyard. It was wild.
terrible is I think in my teen dating experience, I was the reverse. I think I was the one showing liner notes, but I think it was Nine Inch Nails and probably you too also.
Oh, nice. Becca, did
Sorry.
any of your dates think the fight was too long?
No, that fight is not
I want
too
to have one of the
long.
dates go, this is a little long,
This fight
protracted.
scene's been going on for a
I
little
don't
long time. We're
understand.
done. We're done here. Thank
Yeah.
you, sir. You can go.
Great movie.
My way into They Live wasn't even John Carpenter, because I didn't put it together who John
Yeah.
Carpenter was at the time. My way in was Roddy
Hell
Piper,
yeah.
because he was my favorite
Nice.
wrestler. And I was like, he made a movie? And so that's why I saw They Live. My number five. By the end of the 80s, I was consuming so much horror that I won't say I'd grown numb to it, but I wasn't watching it because it scared me. There's a lot of reasons why I love horror movies. Being scared isn't in the top 10 reasons. And yet, to this day, I struggle with Pet Sematary because it's not even the movie, it's fucking Zelda. It's like there's the movie. And then every once in a while, we stop to tell a story about a sister who's bedridden and sick and twists her own neck around. And she's the scariest fucking thing. I used to have to walk through my mom's room to, like, put clothes in the hamper. And I would have to run back out because I was positive Zelda was going to pop up on the bed, just like she does in the movie. I've gotten better about keeping my eyes open during the Zelda scenes when I watch Pet Sematary now. But it still really bothers me. Like, it's still that thing. It's cockroaches for Heather or whatever. It's like this one thing that scares you as a kid, you can't quite get over. you have that almost that automatic nerve response where you're just like, oh, I'm still kind of scared of this. And for me, it's Zelda and Pet Sematary. So Zelda, Pet Sematary reminds me that horror movies still have the power to scare me.
You know, a couple of, I think it was at trivia last month. There was somebody, my daughter was with me. She's 11. And after trivia, I was sitting around, I was talking to somebody, Jared or might have been Collins. And we were talking about the Zelda scene. And Marnie was immediately like, oh, can I see that? Because we were talking about how messed up and scary it is. And Marnie was immediately like, can I see that scene? And for the first, I've never told her she can't watch a horror film in any capacity. I just generally do not, I encourage it, if anything. And immediately I was like, no, you may not. We'll talk when you're 16. You may
That's
not
good.
watch that scene, young lady.
Let her have a childhood. That's
I've
good.
never said that before. Like, we don't, no on the sexual content, but for me to say something, no to something that is just scary, I was like, no, you're not seeing it. We'll talk later, maybe when you're married.
Just show her part two. Jump right
I
in. Who's the big fan of that? Is that Joe Bega? Somebody, it's their favorite movie of all. I can never remember, but
It's Joe
okay,
Bega's, yeah.
that's a wild pick. Yeah, like similar to Heather, in terms of like a visceral reaction. I've told this before, but I have a movie that literally just made me. One movie changed me on a chemical level, and I'm not just saying that. I've never had this experience again on television. I'm 8 years old. The Shining came on TV. Didn't know what it was, and I was just so hypnotized. And it's still the movie that has had the most impact on me to this day. It's the movie I think about the most. It's my favorite movie. And it just, I've never experienced something like that. It being like, of course, I didn't know their tracking shots, but like just being pulled down corridors. And when we Becca was talking about repulsion and attraction being eight, and you're still not fully formed in terms of your sexual things. But then the woman in the bathtub knowing that that was exciting. And then she turns into this like, scary thing. Like all these things just had this quality that I've never had another screening of my life like this. And I remember it so well because I was watching it. It came on with commercials. It's on TV. And the next day I went to school and was just telling everyone about how this changed my life. And I will never forget my best friend, Alex, who I just recorded a podcast with for the first time. I remember telling him and he goes, yeah, I saw it too. Yeah, it sucked. Or being very underwhelmed. And I couldn't believe it. Now it's his favorite movie of all time. So at the time, though, I like to remind him that I was like super excited about this movie that they're all like, we didn't like it. And I don't know, it's so weird when that a movie has that kind of cinematic quality. And obviously, so much of the filmmaking and style now is what we think of as contemporary. I think this film is almost the defining, if we're talking about A24 and Ari Aster and things like that, this is probably one of the true benchmarks of that aesthetic too. So anyway, this movie just it just blew my little head open and made me just want to make not Evil Dead type movies, but something that's even more measured. But love it. Well, I'm glad we all. I mean, I think it's interesting that no one took because the thing that I spent the most time in this decade watching were the Friday the 13th movies. It's like it's no individual one made me. They all just or had an
They're like,
impact. Number three was the first one, but.
I always view them like candy bars. Like while I'm in it, I'm like really into it. But then as soon as I walk away, it's nothing that I, it feels very ephemeral, if that. But I love
Oh, I
them, but
loved
it
them. Love
always,
watching them. They're
I always
ritualistic.
felt so ephemeral to me. It wasn't something that I was like, I, this changed the soul of my being. I'm sure that there are people out there because I know that some people had that effect. With Halloween, which was another, except for Halloween 3, which did change the soul of my being. But that was another one where I was like, I don't know if any of them changed the fabric of my being, but I know people who had that experience.
Well, the cool thing about the 80s is we didn't necessarily watch these things in order, and I do think that's funny. Like, obviously, a couple of us did watch Nightmare One first, and it made a big impression. Do you guys remember your first Friday, just out of interest? I think mine was three, but.
Mine was four.
Okay, interesting.
Five, and it
Oh,
was on
God.
USA Up All Night. Yeah, it was the telekinesis girl because I
Oh,
remember the
yeah.
very
Oh,
first. It was
yeah,
Party
that's
Horn to the. Oh,
seven.
that's six.
Seven.
That's seven.
Yeah, because
So,
five's
yeah,
the
I
not Jason.
had those had never been ones that I was really gravitating to renting. Like, I always wanted the weird stuff. Like, I would have written rented Night Beast over that because it was weird. And so the first one I saw, seven, yeah, it was the telekinesis girl who, and there's a girl who gets a party horn shoved in her eye. And yeah, like that was my first one on USA Up All Night.
I'll do it. What about you, Pat?
Mine might have been three as well. That's the one I have the strongest memories of that I like associate with childhood.
It's the biggest arc of my life is going from not liking Shelley to loving Shelley. Like when I
He's
was
a
a kid, I
tragic
didn't like
character.
Shelley, but now I love Shelley.
Shelley's my
I know. I
lawyer.
love
I love
Larry. I love
Shelley.
Larry now, but when I was
I
young, I
love
didn't.
Larry in real life, but
Larry's
I,
great.
oh
But
gosh,
he brought
I
us the
get so
mask,
mad at
Heather.
Shelley.
He brought the
Poor
mask.
Shelley.
I would be Team Shelley if he didn't
Call her a
Call that
bitch.
one girl a bitch.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's the moment where it's like,
From
shall we
Weekend at
kick rock?
Bernie's? Yeah.
Well, you
Yeah.
guys, thank you for staying up late, especially
Thank you guys
the
so
lateness, Pat.
much.
This was really fun. What should people do who want the book right now, the last couple hundred copies? What will they do? Where should they go?
You can go to aminkpublishing.com. Do I have that right, Heather?
Yes.
Or should they just
Okay.
go to your Twitter and look for a link?
They could do that too. They could, I'm sure there's like a pinned tweet that's on there, or they can come to the signing at Dark Delicacies if you're local to the LA area on April 27th. And
Are you
there's,
coming out for this, Pat?
I am.
Hell yeah.
But there might not be
And there's
copies
a,
by then.
well,
No,
don't
we're
set them
saving copies.
aside.
Yeah,
Oh,
we're set. We
cool.
set like 50 aside for Dells, but I will say that they're getting really close and theirs too.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And there's going to be special guests from 80s horror. It's
Ooh.
not just me and Heather.
Yeah.
Ooh.
No, yeah, we have as far as confirmed yeses, we have Joe Dante, Tom Holland, FX legend Steve Johnson, two of the Kyotos, possibly three Kyotos, and the iconic Kelly Maroney. And we have a few soft yeses as well, that I will be hopefully confirming in early April.
Very cool. Well, thank you guys for spending this time with us, and we're really
Yeah.
glad, it was so fun flicking through it too. And
And we'll see you back for the 90s edition.
yes. And
Oh,
where can people find
gosh.
your guys' show?
Oh,
You
our
wanna?
the
Yeah,
show
go
that
ahead.
Heather and I do together is
Yeah.
called Hanging with Toby Hooper, and you can find it in wherever you listen to your podcast.
Good answer.
We did a whole show on Wes Craven called Craven Craven. We went through all his movies, and now we're on to Toby Hooper.
Yeah, listen. Good
Nice.
stuff.
Oh my God. Excellent. Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We will be back in another 2 weeks. Albert, do we even know what we're doing in 2 weeks?
No, I
Oh,
don't know.
I do.
It's my
We have a
show.
really cool guest, a Canadian filmmaker we have always wanted to chat with. Will be joining us for the show. He looks just fucking perplexed. I'm not
He
even going
better
to
be the
tell him.
person who made the pit, or I'm going to be so upset.
It's
I'm
David
not even.
Cronenberg.
I'm not even going
Cronenberg.
to tell Elric. I'm just going to
But
show up. He'll just pop
he's a
up on Zoom.
podcaster. Cronenberg's a pod. Remember that one movie? Please
Oh
rate
yes.
and
Please rate
rate
and
and
like.
like. You got
And
a
you can
gun.
always find us over at our Patreon show, Deep Cuts, where we have lots of amazing, weird stuff posting up. So thank you all so much, and we will be seeing you soon. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.